Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, happy Sunday. This is Seeds of Change, and I'm your host, Danielle St. John. Mom is with us today. Elizabeth is out hanging out with her fam today. So Mom is filling in.
Good afternoon, everyone.
Hello, hello.
Yes, I'm excited to be here.
If you
want
to be a part of this show, please, you can call 319-527-6208 to listen on the phone. Press 1 if you want to be a part of the show. I don't say that enough, I don't think. So, all right, so what are we talking about today? So, like, I feel like multiple story personality disorder kicking in because there's so much stuff happening in the world that it's really kind of hard to narrow it down. I know that Mom's got about 150 articles
to talk about. At least 150 today.
Yeah. And so, and especially since her usual segment is the good news report, I think we're going to do something a little bit different today. In addition to the good news report, we might have an everything is stupid report. We're not,
yes.
not quite sure
yes.
yet. There's plenty of stupid.
Can you reach that phone number for Megan, please?
Yes, the phone number is 319-527-6208. So, and if you want to be a part of the show, press 1. If you want to just listen, that's the number to listen. Or you can also go to Blog Talk Radio and look up live shows for Seeds of Change.
Wonderful. Okay.
So
what happened? Okay, good. I thought you went out there for a second.
Nope, I'm here. In addition to the current events that we're going to be talking about, it's been a very interesting couple weeks because it seems like I've been being attacked by trolls on virtually all subjects. You know, saying that Pee Wee Herman admittedly had child porn on his computer, trolls coming out and saying that that was hate speech, saying that the trolls are saying that pedophiles shouldn't be judged. That if I'm judging a pedophile, it's considered hate speech, and I was reported. Facebook didn't even bother to to respond back. So. But every week on a different topic, I seem to be getting attacked by trolls. And this week, it was just yesterday that this topic started. And I posted a stupid reel about, everybody else in the world. What's going on? Conspiracy theorists. And it's this guy dancing and shrugging his shoulders like we already knew, right? Somebody comes in and was like, something to the effect of conspiracy theorists, conspiracy theorists are like playing roulette and putting numbers down on, or putting chips down on every number and then saying, ha, I told you so when it lands on your number. First of all, so you're saying I'm right. But second of all, I don't really know. I haven't really been wrong on too many conspiracy theories. Shocking number of them have been right. And then this person comes back at me. Didn't you say that the Twin Towers didn't fall? And it was just a hologram plane. And I said, no, never said anything like that. Are you sure? Yes. There is a lie in 9/11, but I don't think it was a complete hoax. So I asked this person, do you believe the official story? I asked him about 3 different times. And then he comes back at me with this is clearly somebody who's been following me for a long time, saying that the craziest conspiracy theory that I said was that the way to collapse the government is to plant food on the side of the road. So everybody in the audience at Seeds of Change knows that not what I said. What I said is taking back resources from our government, starting with food, news, and health, is how you collapse the government. And yes, planting food on the side of the road is a small part of that. But it's very interesting that they laser focus on this one aspect of the things that I say in order to make me look crazy. Then I take a small break from this conversation after asking this man three times to say or to answer the question of, do you believe the official 9/11 story? I come back to find him arguing with somebody else and calling us all Holocaust deniers. And, you know, and these are these key, you know, phrases that they keep throwing. I wasn't talking about any of that stuff. It was just a fun little video that I posted. But he comes at me with three allegations that are complete crap. And then I say again, do you believe the official story? I don't answer Holocaust deniers. And I said, I'm not a Holocaust denier.
This is typical. This is typical. This is how they do it. It's a common theme on Twitter as well.
Mm-hmm.
They throw out these wild charges, and or you ask them a question, and all they do is start calling you names, and then tell you to go research it yourself, or I don't speak to, you know, whatever bad thing that they're accusing you of, racist, bigotry, anti-Semitism. Yep. Sure.
And this is why I asked a very specific, succinct question. I didn't go off about, well, you know, I asked him what his opinion was. And so, you know, so a lot of that stuff doesn't fly. He can't say for me to go research his opinion myself, you know? But then I said, I'm not a Holocaust denier. And he said, I don't respond to 9/11 deniers.
And you're like, oh, well, I'm certainly not that.
Oh my God. It's just infuriating. And so
that means so we go back to, why would someone spend their time on, and we're talking time. I know. I've done this. The conversation sometimes lasts for conversation. I'm not sure we should really call them conversations, but the color orange is not the color orange. It lasts sometimes for days. People continue to come back. And then they make the nastiest comments. They go and look at your profile. And like on Twitter, that's the thing that they do most is they go look at your profile. And you have Christian in the headline, then you got there's, you know, like legions of a bunch of them jump in and talk about your faith, talk about your, you know, but it's all correct. You are correct, Danielle, of a piece to make you look dumb or crazy.
Yes. Yep.
It's gaslighting.
Exactly.
It's called gaslighting.
Right. And then, you know, usually you get called a QAnon flat earther as well. You know, if you let these interactions continue, you know,
yep.
you get
all the above. Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, and I do understand that a lot of these topics are hard to research on your own. Welcome, caller, by the way. I see you there. Press 1 if you want to be a part of the show. If not, we're just glad you're here. So I do understand that these topics are very hard for a lot of people to research on their own. Trauma-based mind control, it just does that. You know, it just is. That's just the nature of the beast. It's hard. It's hard to research. Caller raised their hand. Let's see. Let's put them in. Hello. Welcome to Seeds of Change.
Hello.
Hi, who's this?
Cindy.
Oh, hi. I thought it was you, but your name doesn't show up on the screen. It just shows a phone number. And I haven't memorized a phone number since 729-8884. So, hi, welcome.
I don't think that's one we'll ever forget. But anyway.
Yeah.
Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for that. I just wanted to say I'm enjoying listening to you guys, so please don't let me interrupt. Go ahead.
Well, if you want to comment, you can just hang out and pop in. We're really loose and free here about that kind of stuff. If there's something that comes up for you that you want to make a comment on, you're absolutely welcome to do it.
I do have a question for you, though. What is your opinion on 9/11? Do you believe the official 9/11 story, or do you believe that there's some lie in this?
I believe that we will never know the entire truth, which is actually just as much of a crime. That I just think it's a crime that we'll never know the entire truth. I do believe that a really bad thing happened. Do I believe that the catalyst that was peddled or sold to us is a complete truth? No, I do not.
Okay. And I think that's where most Americans are. And it's actually pretty striking to hear somebody who actually does believe the official 9/11 story. I mean, hell, we don't even have the full Kennedy assassination story, right? I mean, it's being covered up for, I believe, nefarious reasons. And so, like I said, I do believe that, you know, these subjects are very hard for people to research on their own. I think we were all massively traumatized by 9/11 and other instances, other historical events after 9/11. But, you know, as we get closer to another anniversary of 9/11, I would like to do a series of, you know, some of them may be far-fetched conspiracy theories and some of them are not so far-fetched. And, you know, and then go from there. Basically, a lot of people are really pissed off when you talk about 9/11 on 9/11. A lot of people think that we should be remembering the dead on that day. I can't necessarily disagree with those people, but, you know, and so that's why I've decided to start, you know, 5 weeks early and do, you know, just a little bit either conspiracy or, you know, conspiracy reality or conspiracy theory and see what you guys think about it. I think that we've gotten enough distance between us and the event to actually be able to open up and see what people have said, what people have researched, what people have been silenced on, and especially right after we're coming out of COVID. We can go back and use, you know, history doesn't necessarily repeat itself, but it sure does seem to rhyme. So we can go back and look at things that happened with COVID and see how the experts were silenced in this event, and go back and see how those kind of things were also happening around 9/11. Becky is with us. Hello, Becky. Push one if you want to be a part of the show. If not, thanks for being here. If anybody have anything to add on that, I'm going to pull up a shorter video. I've got a longer one at the end, but if anybody's got anything to add on that while I set up this audio, feel free to jump in.
To hear what you have, some of them I've listened to. Of course, you know I was the one that shrieked and howled the longest at you about, of course, we were attacked and our country, you know, was traumatized, and it changed my life, 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose looking now through the lens of what I've seen over the last 9 years, 8 years, I suppose just about anything is possible with these scurvy, slimy, scum-sucking demons. And so I'm sure that the passions that were aroused and the terror and the distress and the grief and the sadness colored what I believed for a lot of years. And now I've seen just how evil these people can be and what they will do to hold on to power and to create whatever it is they need to create. I mean, so from 9/11, we got the FISA court. So right off the top, and the abuses that have occurred with the FISA court power, tells me a whole lot about just how crummy things have gotten over the last 20, 30 years and and perhaps longer. What they did to us with COVID, what they did to us with the 2020 election, what they did to Donald Trump for the entire time that he was in office and even before, sitting senators, you know, it just doesn't end, and it's continuing to this day. And they are a bunch of power-hungry thugs, and they'll, as far as I'm concerned, nothing is off the table.
Uh-huh. Absolutely. I agree. And so I think a good place to start is around the term cognitive dissonance, right? And I think that's a lot of us live in this world where we can't really look at things or recognize things as truth if it gets in the way of our worldview. And so this is a group of therapists, psychologists, and psychiatrists all talking about cognitive dissonance, specifically surrounding 9/11, but certainly can be applied to other events. So if you guys are ready, I'm gonna play this video. It's about 10 minutes. Is that okay?
Great.
Awesome. All right, here we go. 3, 2, 1.
Most of us who have lived with the events of 9/11 have, as a result, experienced some kind of trauma. It can be very difficult to come to terms with what actually happened at the World Trade Center. In fact, someone told me recently, "I wouldn't believe what you're telling me even if it were true." Our petition signers with psychological expertise have stepped forward to offer their insight. While this segment is clearly outside the knowledge base of the architects and engineers for 9/11 truth, these experts in psychology highlight their valuable experience for us as to why this evidence can still be so difficult for people to accept.
As we know, the horrors of what happened on 9/11 were televised all over the world, and they were televised, in fact, live. We witnessed the deaths of almost 3,000 of our fellow Americans. We know this had a very severe and traumatic impact on a majority of the population. At this point, we have 9 years of hard scientific evidence that disproves the government theory about what happened on September 11th, and yet people continue to be either oblivious to the fact that this information exists or completely resistant to looking at this information. So the question becomes why? Why is it that people have so much trouble hearing this information? From my work, I think we would be remiss not to look at the impact of trauma.
Many people respond to these truths in a very deep way. Some have a visceral reaction like they've been punched in the stomach. To begin to accept the possibility that the government was involved is like opening Pandora's box. If you open the lid and peek in a little bit, it's going to challenge some of your fundamental beliefs about the world.
If we can think of our worldview as being sort of our mental and emotional home, I think all of us will do just about anything to defend our homes, to defend our families. And so I see that with people, and I saw that with myself when my brother tried to talk with me about it, of don't mess with me, don't mess with my home, don't mess with my comfort with how things are. About a week later, I read a lengthy article by Professor Griffin about why he believes the official account of 9/11 cannot be true. And it was a very well-researched article. It was in my office at the time. I sat there and I felt my stomach churning. I thought maybe I was going to be sick. And I leaped out of my chair and ran out the door and took a long walk around the block, around several blocks, and just broke down. I understand now that what was happening was my worldview about my government being in some way my protector, almost like a parent, had been dashed, and it was like being cast out into the wilderness. I think it's the closest way to describe that feeling, and I sobbed and I sobbed, felt like the ground had completely disappeared beneath my feet, and I knew at some point during the walk that I knew that I was going to have to become active in educating other people about this, that for me to retain any sense of integrity, I was going to have to take some action. I couldn't just let something like this go.
When we hear information that contradicts our worldview, social psychologists call the resulting insecurity cognitive dissonance. For example, with 9/11, we have one cognition which is what the official story of 9/11, what our government told us, what our media repeated to us over and over, that 19 Muslims attacked us. On the other hand, we have what scientists, researchers, architects, engineers are now beginning to tell us, which is that there is evidence that shows that the official story cannot be true. So now we've lost our sense of security. We are starting to feel vulnerable. Now we're confused.
9/11 truth challenges the beliefs that our country protects us and keeps us safe, and that America is the good guy. When your beliefs are challenged, fear and anxiety are created. In response to that, our psychological defenses kick in, and they protect us from these emotions. Denial, which is probably the most primitive psychological defense, is the one most likely to kick in when our beliefs are challenged.
And it's a very, very uncomfortable state to be in. And eventually, our mind shuts off. Just like when a computer is overloaded, our minds get overloaded. We can't handle it anymore, and we shut down.
And what some of us will tend to do is deny the evidence that's coming our way and stick to the original story, the official story, and to try to regain our equilibrium in that way. Another thing we can do is decide to look at the conflicting evidence and be sincere and be open-minded and look at both sides of the issue and then make up our own mind about what reality is. Here are a few of those spontaneous initial reactions to hearing the contradictory evidence about 9/11.
I don't want to know the truth, or I'd become too negative and psychologically go downhill. I'm not sure I want to know. If this is true, then up would be down and down would be up. My life would never be the same.
They say, this is the way the world works, and I'm convinced this is the right way the world works. 9/11 doesn't fit into that paradigm, so I don't need to look at the evidence.
Fran, I refuse to believe that many Americans could be that satanically treasonous. Someone would have talked. But these are beliefs. They are not scientific facts. But these beliefs do keep us from looking at the empirical evidence. Whenever we say, I refuse to believe, we can be sure that the evidence that's coming our way is not bearable and that it's conflicting with our worldview much too much. As I thought about all of these responses, I realized that what is common to every one of them is the emotion of fear. People are afraid of being ostracized, they're afraid of being alienated, they're afraid of being shunned, they're afraid of their lives being inconvenienced, they'd have to change their lives, they're afraid of being confused, they're afraid of psychological deterioration, they're afraid of feeling helpless and vulnerable, and they're afraid that they won't be able to handle the feelings that are coming up. None of us want to feel helpless and vulnerable.
Healing comes through facing the truth, experiencing it, allowing the feelings to come in, so that if there are feelings of fear that perhaps these events were caused by something that we haven't thought about yet, dark elements within our society, for example, we'll let that come in and explore it. Let the light shine on whatever happened. This will be the most healing process. The Germans did this after their war. The South Africans did this after apartheid. Reconciliation through the truth is what is a deep path to psychological recovery from the myths and lies around which this historic event has been cloaked in the official view.
One of the ways to deal with a trauma is to find the answers. That's why I think it is of such importance to have a comprehensive investigation.
To work together to expose what happened regardless of where the evidence takes us. That's what we expect in our state government, law enforcement. I think that by putting science together with the law, we will have a psychological healing around the impossible cognition that has been produced on that day.
After World War II, part of the way that Jewish people honored the dead was by making sure that the truth was known and that the value of these people was respected. Not pursuing the truth about 9/11 disrespects the value of the life of the people that died. Thinking that we're above such things, that it could happen in other countries, but it couldn't happen here, that's a lack of humility, and that's excessive pride. And so not being able to see our dark side or our weaknesses is the most dangerous thing.
A feature of American history that makes us particularly liable to this pride is this notion that's called exceptionalism, that America is the exceptional nation. And that began from the beginning as this country was formed. The people would say, well, there was so much evil in the European country, so much cheating, so much lying, so much using the people for the rulers' purposes, but not in America. We have leaders that are free from those sins. So I think this has made 9/11 particularly difficult for Americans.
So we need to understand that questioning is patriotic. Questioning is what we're supposed to do as citizens. That's our duty.
One thing that has become important for me personally is to educate myself, is to take responsibility. There's that wonderful quote from Mahatma Gandhi where he said that we must be the change that we wish to see in the world.
When we come to the national level, when something like 9/11 happens, we need to be sure that we have a real investigation into who the perpetrators are, and then we need to be sure that those perpetrators are held legally accountable. It's part of the healing process on the individual level as on the collective level. We need the truth in order to heal.
All right. First, there's a caller with their hand up. I'm going to let them in. Hello. Welcome to Seeds of Change. Who's this? Hello? 619 number?
Oh, that's me?
Is that you, Michael?
That's Michael.
Oh, hello. Welcome.
Thank you.
It looks like there's also a Skype listener. Welcome. Press 1 if you want to be a part of the conversation. If not, we're just glad you're here. Anybody have any, Mike, I know, Michael, you got in a little bit late on that last one, but, you know,
yeah.
If anybody's got any thoughts to share about the cognitive dissonance surrounding 9/11, feel free.
Well, I do, and that's exactly how I was for a very long time. It took COVID and some other stuff to make me kind of let go of that, to understand that even though I was in pain and sad and grieving over what happened, it was still important that our own government perpetrated that just horrific, horrific thing on our country, and which is still very sad and is still enraging. But the possibility does not make me want to run away and cry and scream and yell the way that I used to.
Right. So, Michael, do you have any – Michael, just a quick question. Do you believe the official 9/11 story, or do you think there was some lie in that?
There was a lot of lie in it and a lot of cover-up, but I think it goes way deeper. When we look forward from 9/11, you know, the COVID, all the policies, and all the things that have been implemented, we've been taken over from the inside. It's been a slow and tedious process, but they bought people. I'm pretty sure that a lot of our politicians, judges, and what have you, they're under threat from people with a lot more money than any of us could ever imagine. That's how we got here. I believe that we're at a point right now where nothing less than a civil war 2.0 is going to change this. I think we're past the point of being able to fix it. Even when Trump got elected, I said, look, he's a Band-Aid. You know, he's a temporary fix. He opened a lot of people's eyes. But, you know, I mean, they came back 10 times harder. They own all the media, all the press. You can't fight that because, you know, most people, they don't have the critical thinking skills to understand exactly what they're being told, exactly what's going on. You know, I mean, you have to analyze this from a critical thinking point of view and say, wait a minute, this doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. Why would anyone with the common sense that God gave a doorknob do these things or make these decisions for the country? I mean, even the lowest IQ of a person can't be so stupid to think that some of these Democrat programs are going to work for the country or make anything better for anything. They create a problem, then create an imaginary fix for it, but it never gets fixed. But somebody makes a whole lot of money on it.
True.
You know, I think where we are right now is, coming up in this next election, what do we have? You know, I know it's still a year away. I'm a big fan of Ron DeSantis, but I don't think he's got, the backing. And they're going to do just their pure media assault on Trump is not going to allow him to be elected. They're just aren't enough critical thinking Americans in the country to let that happen.
Mm-hmm. You could be right about that.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Well, and that's why I think you're completely right. You know, I have to push back on one thing. So almost completely right. I have to push back on one thing. I think a civil war the government, the military, we're going up against the biggest killing machine in the history of humankind. I think that violence in any way is going to be met with an immediate shutdown. And so what I've been saying and what I've been trying to promote for, since I ran for Congress in 2018, is a non-hostile takeover of our communities, taking back resources from the government, starting with food, news, and health. Right. And so I get a lot of flack. People are like, oh, yeah, planting foods in community gardens and sides of the roads, that's really going to save us, but that's a small part of it. What else, you know, it's
well,
just really getting people.
Self-sufficiency would go a long way. Yeah.
Yes.
I agree with that.
And I think that has to be at least the basis of any kind of major change, because how are we going to have a revolution if we can't feed ourselves? You know, they control all of it. We, you know, the further down
exactly.
these rabbit holes
and
we go.
They won't let you do that, though. They won't let you do that in a lot of places. You're not allowed to, go completely off the grid or anything like that, you know.
Sure.
And they're doubling down on that. You know, now they're trying to take away natural gas. And, it's a clear takeover of our country. We are already in a civil war.
So what are we going to do about it? Like, that's what I'm saying is it's clear. We all see the problems very clearly. What is the solution?
We would all like to find an unviolent solution. Unfortunately, I just don't see that happening.
Yeah. And I'm not saying give up your guns.
An unviolent
as a matter
solution
of fact,
at this
get
point.
As many guns as we possibly can, you know, because we still have to protect what is ours. And that is a constitutional right that we have. Right, to protect these things, to protect our crops, to protect our families.
Yeah, protecting your homestead and protecting your families, that's a whole different thing. You know, I mean, look, we already have all the guns. The gun control issue is another thing that's just, it's ridiculous to even fight about it. Because, look, anybody can make a gun with a 3D printer. You know, if you have $700, you can make as many guns as you want. If you have high school shop skills, you can make an extraordinary amount of weapons. We don't need the right or the law to tell us to do that. What we need is, exactly. So what we need is people that are willing to just stand up and realize that we're being taken over. Our Constitution has just been stomped into the ground. The more they try to take our rights, the more we are moving to the place that we fought in 1776 to get away from. That's where we're at. And that's what it took back then. And I don't think that we've progressed so much. I think a lot of these progressives and liberals think that, you know, just because, you know, it's 250 years later that people are smarter, but they're not. A lot of people refuse to learn from history. They have their own ideas and think they know better. But in the end, we're all just human beings with the same desires and the same ways of thinking. And I wish we could find a pleasant way to end this, but I don't think it's going to happen.
I don't think we're going to find a pleasant way to end this, but what I do think is that we can soften the blow of what comes next. And that's what, when you say that people don't have the mental capacity right now to be able to see what's going on, I think that a big part of that has to do with the fact that we eat crap, you know, that we eat, you know, the things that are the cheapest. We don't, you know, our foods are injected with who knows what, and pesticides are all over everything. And screw it, I'm going to go to McDonald's because it's cheaper, you know. So what do you think would happen to a population if they actually had the proper nutrition available? And I'm not talking about, you know, being anti-capitalist. I'm not saying that McDonald's has to go out of business. But you know, if we can give people a choice between, you know, fresh produce that you can't really afford in the grocery store, and I'm not saying free shit. I'm not saying that, you know, people should get free shit. What I'm saying is that if we can sustain ourselves, you know, without – that's the thing about sustainability, is that somebody has to sustain it, right? We can't just have – you know, sit back and say, oh, gimme, 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 go out to the garden, to even the side of the road if we have to. And there have been several times throughout history, human history, where people were, you know, in this oppressed. And yes, honestly, I believe that we're slaves. I think that no matter what color we are, that we're slaves to this system. But people,
figured out
how to get out of it.
And that's where schools teach. Schools teach you to be an obedient worker bee. They don't teach you to be self-sufficient. They don't teach you to be a business person and open your own business and be successful. And I think what really is the pressing issue, families are scared. You know, they just want to feed their families, you know, and they prey on that. They prey on that because they know these people aren't going to raise a fist or a gun until they've literally taken everything from them. And that's just kind of the way the psychological human brain works. You know, these really good, God-loving people who just work hard and want to, you know, raise their families, they'll put up with a lot of shit, man, until you push them to the breaking point. And I think that's what they're really shooting to do. Because everything they do is going towards that, you know. On the flip side, yes, everything you said is absolutely true. We should be self-sufficient. But, you know, I mean, the way major cities are set up, the big metropolitan cities, they can't do that there. You know, all these people in apartment buildings, high rises, these are the people that are not going to agree with you. No matter what, because they can't even fathom being able to do that. They don't have the facilities. They don't have the knowledge. And
let me ask a question, though, Michael. Hold on. Because of what we've been through this last 8-9 years, it is my opinion that the stuff that you're saying, of course, has been traditionally true. I can tell that this is an issue because of this sort of the people that you consider to be, I suppose, just sort of mind screwed, okay? And they just won't think for themselves, and they just want it. And then you mentioned this whole other subset of people that they're starting to get frightened, they're starting to get scared, they're starting to wake up and think about protecting their families and thinking about standing up and putting their fist in the air and this other business. Do you think, or have you seen, like I have, that it is a massive amount of people that are doing exactly that, that are starting to consider issues of self-sufficiency and that are starting to consider issues of self-protection? Your state, when you moved to Florida, so Danielle Teresa, I just want a little history with Michael. I've known Michael for a lot of years, and for many years we went back and forth about it, making the decision to get up out of California, because I suppose we have this sort of dystopian reflex, both of us, because of how bad things have gotten over the last 20 years here in our beloved state. Michael is a California native, just like we are. Mm-hmm. And he got up and he moved to Florida. And so when I sort of framing this question to you, Michael, about, we think that, we talk about the sort of sheeple and they're just not going to protect themselves. And yet millions of people have left this state just the way that you did. They all decided that, no, it's too dangerous. It's too bad here in California, this dystopian sort of mindset. And Tennessee has had a population explosion. Florida has had a population. There's all kinds of states all over the United States Texas has grown by leaps and bounds. People are moving out of these blue states that we look at them and go, what are you thinking? And the sort of just the madness that we're seeing, that the government, when you talked about from the inside, our government's been taken over. If we have a wonderful example of that, it's here in our state. I'm still right here, by the way.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
So even though you're, lots of, don't let me say doom and gloom, that, they're just not going to do it. Okay.
I was a mechanic most of my life. I was a technician. I was an electrician. I love figuring out problems.
Right. I know you do.
And I'm not saying that these people that aren't capable of critical thinking are stupid. I'm just saying
no.
That they just never occurred to them that the news and the media that they watch every day and the schools and their teachers are telling.
Okay.
Are
so
not
there you
telling
go.
The truth.
Okay. So stop your
You know what I mean?
So,
yeah.
The one thing that Donald Trump did for us is showed us who the media are. People have turned off traditional media by the millions. The other thing, during COVID, now we know what they've been doing in our schools. So I'm telling you that while, yes, this critical thinking issue is a problem, or has been, Jersey Shore, dare I say, I think it's changing. And I just want to know what you think about that. But first, before you go on, Cindy, what do you think? That's my sister. Hold on just a second.
Okay.
Go ahead, sister.
I wanted to speak to Rosebud's original, the subject.
That's me.
Of the show today. I wanted to speak. It's funny that you would choose this subject. Let me start with because
no, it's not because she's a freak.
So I spoke to a nurse like 9/11 really doesn't come to the forefront of your brain in the last few years until we get again close to that date and some of the sadness starts to creep back in because it was so intense so long right after it happened. So I spoke to an RN this last week. She was a Navy nurse stationed at Camp Lejeune on the day of 9/11.
There you go.
And she said that when the first plane hit, that all of the superiors in the Naval Hospital, and I've been in that hospital, I know what it's like, ran around like nuts, shutting off TVs in patient rooms, waiting rooms, offices, like they do. I don't know. She said this. I don't know if they got orders from headquarters, basically. And she's a very good nurse. She's been in the civilian world only a few years now. But anyway, she said they just ran around unplugging televisions, shutting them off, telling people everything's okay, under the premise that the reason was to keep people calm in the hospital. They had patients to look out for first, basically, their mental health, too. So that was part of it. And she didn't understand. No, it's not like she was an enlisted person. She was an officer and an RN. So her critical thinking skills were sharp and still are to this day.
Mm-hmm.
So that leads me to this question. Does anybody feel like maybe before that, honest to goodness, love of country, patriotism had lulled so much that no matter the genesis of that awful day, that it felt a resurgence for a very short period afterward, right? And then
yes, I was one of those people.
Correct.
Newly sober. Correct. Yeah. And all of a sudden, I realized that I really did love my country. I was able to feel love, so yes.
Right. And I feel like since COVID, which they peddled as pneumonia in December before it all, hit the fan, and wasn't really a big deal, it was just pneumonia. But anyway, they peddled all of their, BS or whatever. But I feel like since then, since they made such grand gestures as far as our freedom, that resurgence of love of country, of patriotism, has really boiled up a little, bubbled up a little bit more.
Yep.
And
no question about
it. To Rosebud's point, it maybe doesn't have to be a full-on civil war or whatever. I feel like sustainable living is a form of resistance, and that's really what it was. Before the Civil War, there was just resistance. Before the Revolutionary War, resistance. So I feel like instead of immediately going to let's just have a civil war,
let's fight. Yep.
Let's mutiny. Let's have a coup of the federal government. I feel like resistance in small communities, resistance in your soul is where it has to start, because we've taken on this parent child thing in our head that, the federal government's the parent, we're the children.
Daddy.
All the time.
Yes.
You're told.
Yes.
But once you become a teenager,
you start to fight.
You
start to resist. Yes, absolutely.
Resistance.
Okay. So what a great thing that you just did, because it's absolutely, the parallels are there.
Yeah.
That with when they, because they had control over everything after 9/11. Definitely, we just saw it in stark relief with COVID. No
with
question
COVID,
about
precisely.
It.
Yep.
And we did, and lots of people bowed down. It didn't take Danielle very long, didn't take me very long to say, wait a minute, these people are pulling a freaking really ugly shenanigan
now. Our logical brains kicked back in, right? We were in this, traumatized zone, and then quickly, more quickly than most people, snapped out of it, right? So I'd like to play, and one thing that I have to I'm not going to say disagree, but add on to, Cindy, you said, mom, she's like my second mom. So I it's hard to call her Cindy, but, one of the things that you talked about is small towns And I can tell you that San Diego is certainly not a small town. And we pushed back hard when it came to COVID, and especially when it came to our children. As a matter of fact, San Diego was one of the first school districts to quote unquote mandate, whatever the fuck a mandate is, excuse me, but the COVID vaccine
it's
for our children.
So do as you're told, don't question me, daddy. Thing.
Right.
Yeah.
So as soon as this happened, actually it happened during, I'm sure you guys are familiar with Clay and Buck, the Clay and Buck show.
Here we are.
Yep. Okay. They put out, as soon as this mandate came down during their show, and this was in October of 2021. And so they opened up the phone lines for people to call in, parents to call in especially, and weigh in on this subject, on the mandate for San Diego Unified School District children. And I actually was able to be on the Clay and Buck show with my opinion because I had children in the school district. I'd like to play it's less than 3 minutes clip of me being on Clay and Buck and this is what San Diego did on this very limited scope issue. But this is something that we have to do for every issue when it comes to taking back resources versus a civil war. So if you guys are ready, less than 3 minutes. Here we go. 3, 2, 1.
Welcome back in. Clay Travis, Buck Sexton Show. We are rolling through the Thursday edition of the program. Appreciate all of you hanging out with us. Encourage you to download the podcast. Make sure you don't miss a moment. You can search out my name, Clay Travis, or Buck Sexton on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, everywhere, Google Play, that you might be interested in listening to the podcast. And you'll be able to even find that just by typing in Clay or Buck, which is a good sign about the growth of the show and also probably a sign that there aren't a lot of other Clays and Bucks out there with podcasts. We got a lot of parents who want to weigh in about the idea of mandatory vaccinations for school-age children 5 to 11, which is what Dr. Scott Gottlieb said he expects to potentially be permissible. Again, if you want to go get your kid vaccinated for COVID, I think you should be able to do that. But the idea of what Gavin Newsom is doing in California and what I believe many other governors are going to do as well and try to mandate all school children get this is a major red flag and a big no for me as a parent of a 6-year-old and an 11-year-old. My kids are not getting vaccinated for COVID. I think they probably already had it, because both my wife and I have had COVID. We haven't gotten them antibody tested, but we know they're at virtually no risk from COVID, and it makes no sense to put this vaccine in their body, in my opinion. But some of you may disagree. Some of you may agree. Let's go to Danielle first up on the Clay Travis and Buck Sexton Show.
Hello. I just wanted to say that my message is very simple. We will not comply. And that is precisely the opposite of being a domestic terrorist. We're just not
Amen.
We're withdrawing consent, right? We're just taking the consent away. That has nothing to do with violence.
Thank you. Danielle, where do you live? What state?
I live in California. I'm in San Diego Unified School District.
And Danielle, can I ask you, my understanding is that first of all, Newsom said there'll be a mandate for children to get vaccinated for next fall. The vaccine hasn't even been approved for children yet, but that's for the 12 up age group, I guess, but I'm sure he'll expand that. Where do teachers fall into this? Are they finally now forced to get the shot or lose their jobs, or have they still been stalling?
Well, it's interesting. They actually are under the mandate. However, they are allowed religious exemptions where our children basically are not.
Right.
That's interesting. Thank you for the call. I mean, I think it's going to be a major challenge. And I told you, Buck, that my phone started ringing as soon as this mandate was announced.
It's almost like a big plot by the Tennessee and Texas, I don't know. It's not the tourism board, the come live here board, whoever's in charge of that,
it is the best pitch they could have.
Yeah, there's no better recruitment for moving to a red state than Gavin Newsom or Kathy Hochul in New York State.
Okay, so thoughts on that?
I remember when that happened. I remember being terrified for my grandchildren.
But guess what we did? What did we do?
We didn't take the vax.
The mandate went away. There is no mandate right now.
And we won.
Yep. Oh, bye, Mom, Aunt Cindy.
Okay, she said she's got to go. Yeah. She has to walk the dog. And she said to tell Rosebud she's great at this.
Oh, thank you.
Yes.
For the record, I never subscribed to the whole COVID thing. I was an RV technician at the time, working on RVs from all over the country. I refused to wear a mask. I didn't wear gloves. I didn't participate in that. I wore a mask
rebel,
a couple
Danielle.
Of times to go to the
Mike
grocery store because I had to. Because I knew it was bullshit.
Yeah.
I wasn't scared of it. You know?
None of us were.
None of it made sense to me. Now,
I have to admit, I was for about 2 weeks. And then my logical brain kicked back in. But back to you.
2 weeks, yeah. That's about right.
And like I said, you know, I'll stipulate everything about the COVID and all the insanity our government's been doing. But you have to look at the core reason for it all.
What
Why
is the
are
reason,
they
Michael?
Doing it?
What is the reason? Because I have a theory. What is your theory?
Subjugation. Subjugation.
Yes. Yes.
They want to
yes.
see how many people will comply with and just be, you know, good little worker bees. And, yes, the government says I need to do this, so I'm going to do that. And you know what's really crazy is most of these people, like I remember the JFK Democrats, you know, I respected them. It was a whole different it was a whole different scene than what we have today. These
true.
People are insane.
We were Democrats, my whole family, for decades, Michael. Yeah, it's not
exactly.
the same.
Yep. Exactly. It's not the same party anymore, and it's not the same fight. And like I said, the only logical reason changed is that we've been taken over from the inside. So we have people in power who are either in debt to foreign countries, owned by foreign countries, or threatened
blackmailed
by foreign
by
interests.
Pedophilia.
Yeah, I mean, you can run the gamut of what it is, but they've been doing this for decades.
Yes.
Because the only way to take down the most powerful military country in the world is from the inside out. And they're doing it. And they're doing it well. And that scares the shit out of me, man.
And what do you think about withdrawing consent as a solution? Like what I said on Clay and Buck, that my message is very simple. We will not comply. And that is completely the opposite of violence, domestic terrorism. We're not going and destroying anything.
Well, that'll go so far because I, like I said, I think there are too many people. I think they've kind of tipped the balance in this country to where 51% of the people will comply. And that,
sure, and
that
we saw that with
problem.
COVID, with the vaccines, for sure. But, I mean, I think between you and me and the listeners and the fence post, I don't think that the people who complied with the schedule of vaccinations, I don't think they're going to be here for too much longer.
Who, the people, what, that took the shots? I agree.
You know, I think we should love them and honor them while they're here because those people who are in our way will not be in our way too much longer. And that's the easiest, you know, the kindest way that I can say it. Learn from these libraries of people who fell for this, who fell for allowing the government
that, but
to...
But you also have to look at, you know, the population increases every day. Every day, a new voter, hundreds of thousands of new voters. Yes, you know, and I think they calculated this very well. I don't think that this is an accident, you know, that it came down at this particular point in time when they have our colleges, our universities, and they're putting all this poison into our kids' minds. You know, there's only so many good parents to go around to straighten their kids out and tell them the truth that aren't too busy, you know. Just trying to put food on the table. I think their master plan is working great, unfortunately.
For sure. You look at Sun Tzu's Art of War. You know, you have to know your enemy. There's no way to defeat your enemy unless you know them and respect what they're doing, knowing that they're 150 steps ahead of us until very recently. I really do think that COVID, you know, for better or for worse, allows people... Yeah, they woke up, like, a lot of us. And the ones that didn't wake up took the shot. And, you know, we see, you know, the died suddenly groups all, you know, like, this I really do believe this is, in my opinion, I'm not a scientist, but in my opinion, I believe this was a bioweapon. To, you know, we are the carbon that they're trying to reduce.
I do as well. And the only thing that I'm not sure of is whether it was set off by our country or theirs. You know,
we're going to get
people here in parts of in places of power that are complicit in implementing this stuff for their own personal gain.
There's no question about it. So we've finally gotten to the point where, okay, it was a lab leak. All right, yes. But I'm waiting for the spoiler where we find out that it wasn't an accident, and that's coming.
And it was released from more than one place. It was released from Wuhan, but it was also released from Norfolk, Virginia,
and I think Central California as well.
Possibly. Now that's new, right? But yeah.
So that's my opinion. That's just saying. It's my opinion. Yikes. So Michael, at 4 o'clock, I get to do the good news report.
Okay, but are we going to do the good news report or the everything is stupid report first?
I think we're everything is stupid. I'm going to start off with the good news, actually.
Oh, good.
Because we could use
we
a bump.
Some?
I actually do, believe it or not. The good
Trump's
news.
Trump's third indictment. That's good news, right? Because it
Okay, so there's, you know, it's interesting because I suppose I have there's a lot of irony in my good news report. I always believe that when we get this kind of what I consider crazy news, it's good news because the more informed that people are and can step back and go, they can't do that. No, wait a minute. They can't do that stuff. Are you kidding me? That's not possible.
I've been staying there my whole life, but they keep doing it.
Right. But here's the thing. But the more yes, you have, Michael, and you know,
I haven't.
Probably,
sorry to interrupt, but, you know, I make amends every day for being a Democrat up until 2016. You know, I was a Democrat. I thought it was her turn, you know, and then I you know, wanted to vote for Bernie and all of these things. But you know what? I woke up and I make amends for that every day. And so all of those people who are like, no.
I remember, Danielle, when me and you went at it online. I think you blocked me at one point.
I was still
like, okay, I'll admit it. Okay, well, so let's start off with some really great news. Pfizer loses $144 billion in value as Americans move on from COVID treatment and drugs, right? According to the Daily Mail, and you will notice, Michael, I will always give credit to the because I do a lot of reading and I do a lot of quote unquote digging, I suppose, because I refuse to watch television. Many of the people that I interact with quote databases it's on Telegram, which I will always give credit to Telegram too, because there's a lot of real news over there. Imagine that. When I say real news, I mean the stuff that the media ignores. That's always the more important.
I mean, a lot of times you got to think about the news. You know, Pfizer losing all that money, we're still going to pay for it.
One way or the other, aren't we? Okay,
they're just
going to
raise their prices. You know, it's kind of like the landlord rental thing. You know, me being a landlord myself, you know, that's the path I went when I moved to Florida. Look, when they raise taxes, when they raise this, when they raise that, I'm not paying for it. You are.
Of course.
Yep.
You
know,
and that's what people need to understand.
And
even
I have
with
surrendered
Bud Light.
To that. I understand. Not that I would ever buy a Pfizer product ever again in life. Okay. Certainly all the money that my tax dollars went to Pfizer, we've already paid times 1 billion. So yes, but still I'll take, okay. So this is the reason for the good news, Michael. Yeah, and you can argue with every single one of them. You're absolutely correct that at some point it's gonna get hosed, but that's not the point. We'll take our little victories.
I'm not gonna argue. I'm just, you know, I'm just trying to save my.
We will take our little victories, where we get them, when we get them, and how we get them. Pfizer lost $88 billion in market share and $144 billion in value since its market peak in just 1 year, as the drug maker suffers a major hangover from the success what? The success of its COVID vaccine. The pharmaceutical giant enjoyed a record $100 billion in sales last year, powered by its COVID vaccine and drug. But after becoming the first pharma firm to break the billion-dollar barrier, its performance has fallen off, which that makes me happy. Performance has fallen off. I hope it falls off into off into a freaking cliff. More good news. Elon Musk posted on Twitter this morning and said, if you were unfairly treated by your employer due to a posting or liking something on this platform.
I saw that. That's awesome.
We will fund your legal bill. No limit.
Hell yeah.
And of course, after he posted that, so there are 112,600 retweets, 23,500 quotes, 627,000 likes, 28,400 bookmarks. So, and then there's the comments, and there are thousands of people that are stepping up and saying, I would like you to help me with my legal bills because I was fired for going on this site and liking a post, following someone who's considered not part of the, you know, the approved narrative, right?
And I would like to see a lot of these other multi-billion-dollar companies step in and do
step
the same
up.
Thing.
Well, okay. So here's the thing.
That's what we need to see.
This kind of lawsuit, this kind of legal action will stop them from doing this in the future, because before there wasn't any downside. They got all the kudos from the freaking silly people, the silly buggers, right? That would, you know, they would do one of those little campaigns.
Exactly.
And
if we get more companies to step in and support this,
that's what
then
I mean.
We get to take care of all the people in retrospect.
I agree.
In addition to it happening again in the future. So that's what we really need.
I'm loving every bit of it.
I don't think we're going to see that. I think the Democrats, the whole Democrat machine is so connected with these billion-dollar corporations.
They're
doing the censoring and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, but they're losing money. But I think they're promised something on the back end.
Of course.
The only thing that makes
I don't think we should eliminate the Republicans from that equation as well. I'm not talking about some of the newer ones.
No, definitely not. The Republicans are just as dirty, and I agree with that.
There you go.
Yes, ma'am.
I
don't know if
thing happened.
I don't know if I can't hear you, Mom. Can you please repeat that?
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yeah.
I can, yeah.
I can hear
you
now. You got it for me.
I moved my microphone, and I was puffing on my vape, so what can I say? Sorry. I won't do that again. Anyway, in the last 3 months since the Dylan Mulvaney fiasco, about seven of the DEI, that pop quiz, Danielle, Michael, what does DEI stand for?
Direct Electronics Incorporated and Vista?
No. Diversity. Diversity, inclusion and something. Maybe I said DEI.
That was my next
Diversity, inclusion. Diversity, equity and inclusion. DEI, they all hired this huge, all of these Fortune 500 companies hired these huge departments for DEI. And a bunch of them have gotten fired in the last 2 months. So back to your point, Michael, it looks like it's heading in the right direction. These corporations, because of the woke mobs, hired a bunch of people in these DEI and made some of the craziest, nastiest, just most vicious, and then would jump when the woke mob would go after one of their employees for liking a post, for God's sakes. Here's one lady.
Yeah.
Trans activist appears to get woman fired for following libs of TikTok, other conservatives on Twitter. All she did was follow them. She followed them.
And maybe the quick definition of libs of TikTok, basically it was an account on TikTok that would curate liberal
crazy stuff. Yes.
And post it. and repost it. These are things that are not edited, you know, but were put
that's
out on TikTok and share them.
Okay, that's all she would do.
Well here's, because, here's my concern with that whole idea, and this is my problem with it. Someone in these multi-billion-dollar corporations with the hands that hold the strings are making these decisions.
They're CIA agents.
And these losses that we see, you know, I mean, I saw this post the other day. You know, Joe Biden was bragging about all these industrial corporations put $450 million, you know, last year. Dude, Apple put that much in 1 year by itself, you know, in 2021. And it's like, dude, that kind of money is nothing to these people.
I know.
And like I said, I'm more concerned that they're playing a long game. We know that they've always played with the numbers, you know.
Of course.
You can't trust any polls. You can't trust anything. What you can trust is when you go to the grocery store or the gas pump and you see what's happening. You know,
right.
And for me, and I think for everyone else in the country, I think that's eventually going to get home. And that's the only really deciding factor that's going to drive people to think, hey, wait a minute. You know,
well, that's the point. Yes. People just stand up and say, stop, this doesn't make any sense, just like you.
Mm-hmm.
So the next piece of good news is about mask studies. Alex Berenson posted a study called the School-Associated SARS-CoV-2 Transmission. Interestingly enough, what they found, you'll be very surprised, is that masks don't work and that kids don't get COVID. So they did a massive...
I know you can't see me, but I have a shock face on.
I know you do. I know you do. This is radio, but I can assume that the radio...
You just found this out today?
Okay. So let's say, first of all, that the good news is that we're actually able to see these studies because they were doing them the entire effing time, but they wouldn't let anybody see them because they were being censored. Thank you to the state of Louisiana and Missouri and Louisiana for suing the Biden administration and all the Twitter files coming out that the CIA and the FBI were definitely censoring our posts, in particular this guy right here, Alex Berenson, okay, from the start
part of
COVID.
Disinformation dozen, right?
Okay, so I got distracted. The Tucker clip is in Seeds of Change, Danielle.
Okay, so
these studies were being done all along. We've known all along. You're correct, Michael. We've been trying to howl from the rooftops. My daughter in particular was a gorilla. We was doing gorilla masking things in San Diego, running all over San Diego, going to stores and forcing people to serve
also
her without
known
a mask.
Also known as grocery shopping.
So we've known the entire time, but they... As a rule, the public was not aware of these studies because they were censored and they were mocked and they were, you know, like crazy talk. Well, they did do a study on...
Well, I mean, we were taught in school to believe in the CDC, you know. They're looking at your best interests.
Okay. Absolutely.
Until they're not.
And the medical community disgraced itself. The scientific community disgraced itself. And along
it did.
With...
Look at how many doctors got fired because they didn't go along with the program.
Okay.
You know?
So they did a study in Massachusetts. In the cohort study of 10 Massachusetts school districts, the secondary attack rate of SARS-CoV-2 in schools was 2.2% during the 2020-2021 school year and 2.8% in the fall of 2021. Factors associated with transmission in schools changed over time, although a greater social vulnerability index was associated with transmission in both periods. So what Alex Berenson says is that, first of all, only 44 kids, okay, for the fall 2021, researchers looked at 34 schools with 18,000 students. They found at most 44 in-school infections. And this is 18,000 students, including staff. You read that right. 18,000 students, 34
yep.
schools, 44 COVID cases. Never close schools again. And then he made a joke. He said apparently the ones that got it the most were both persons were wearing masks. Okay? So, so there we go. More good news. In Massachusetts state troopers reinstated after wrongful termination for COVID vaccine refusal.
Yeah.
We recently told you CNN and others are trying to spark a summer COVID panic. Don't fall for it, by the way. Meanwhile, some wrongs from the days of peak pandemic panic are finally being righted. This is by Fuzzy Chimp on Twitchy. I always give credit. I love Twitchy. It's a great place to quickly get the news of stuff that interests me. Telegram, Twitchy are two of the sites that I follow very carefully. Seven state troopers from the state of Massachusetts will be allowed to return to work, and they'll receive back pay. In other words, the government overreacted. These law enforcement workers got cheated out of their jobs, and the taxpayers, here you go, Michael, ultimately got to pay them for over a year's worth of stress-filled paid vacation. This is the end result of the divisive policies pushed by politicians headed by the Biden administration as the impact of COVID was in decline. Okay, so very nice. Seven state troopers are going to get their jobs back.
That is good news.
Really good news. Danielle's going to play a clip, a two-minute clip. One of the things that has been enraging for me, of course, again, with stuff that people believed and stuff that people didn't believe, and that was the 2020 election and also what happened on January 6th. Danielle's going to play a clip of one of the head Capitol Police officers that was silenced when they did the J6 quote-unquote investigation with all those freaking idiots up there on Capitol Hill. There was a bunch of feds there. Oh, here we go with the shock face again, and now we're going to get the proof. Go ahead, Danielle. Did you find
it? Please chime up if this is bad audio.
I'll let you know.
Okay.
And rational and not given no statement, obviously, but the facts that you were describing are shocking. About the state, the reason why I've had a lot of people ask me, you know, why did you write this book? I try to do what I can to get the truth out.
Yes.
You know, they didn't want me to testify in February 23rd at the Senate hearing. They don't want people to still currently in the
Okay, hold on, hold on.
Shoot. Had to go and talk.
They're censoring us. Hold on.
Of course.
I'll rewind it. Don't worry.
We have a
3-hour show for a reason.
Right.
Let's try this.
Let me just set it up while Danielle's getting it ready. So this was one of the final shows that Tucker did on his daily. He did a daily show for the Fox News app. It was Tucker Carlson during the day. And he interviewed.
Can I interject a little something about the January 6th hearings?
Yes, please.
Here's the thing. They're reaching. Trump did nothing wrong.
Of course.
Nothing that he said or did on that day, including the phone calls to Georgia and all that stuff, all that's protected under presidential privilege, First
of
Amendment.
Of course.
He didn't make any threats. He didn't do anything wrong. Nothing is illegal. You know, we already know that all of these indictments are just BS.
Of course.
They are. They're not going to convict him of anything, just like they didn't convict him of anything, you know, in the beginning, Russia, all that stuff. The Democrat playbook never changes.
It doesn't.
Them doing the same thing they've always done. There's nowhere to go with this. They're going to, and after the election's over and all charges are dropped, you know, whatever happens in which that's what I'm more concerned with is what are we looking at come 2024?
I agree. I heard that your premise was that he's unelectable at this point. I disagree, but So well, I'd like you to listen
too,
to...
But what my point is that they've still convinced 51% of the population.
It's not 51% anymore.
That's incorrect. That's incorrect.
That is incorrect.
I'd like to believe that.
Well,
but they're
going
to steal it again, and there's nothing we can do about it. So what happens then?
8% of the population gave us the choice between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. 8%. 70% don't vote.
This is an election for our lifetimes, Michael. And let me just tell you, here we go with the parallels again. Because of COVID, everything's different now. Everybody is awake in a way. Well, let me say, more people are awake than ever before. 68% of people, 68% of people, and this includes independents and Republicans, believe that the 2020 election was stolen. Now we know what happened on January 6th, and I want you to pay attention to what he says, because Jack Smith, the indictment that they just put out, is based on the bullshit that came out with that Senate, quote-unquote, Senate trial. Listen to what the first line of what this guy says. Go ahead, Danielle.
Sure.
Okay, here we go. Oh, I might need to sit through a commercial again. Hold on. Damn, hold on.
Let this soft oral melt in your mouth to rebuild your gums
don't,
and teeth.
Probably don't do that. Hold on. Okay.
Did you know there
is
a piss off?
Very
restrained and rational and not given an overstatement, obviously, but the facts that you're describing are shocking.
The reason why did you write this book? I try to do what I can to get the truth out.
Yes.
You know, they didn't want me to testify in February 23rd at the Senate hearing.
Stop.
They don't want people that are still currently in the position actually had to go in and talk.
Did you say stop?
Okay. So I did say stop, and he said they would not even let him testify at the Senate hearing. So if you remember, it was a kangaroo court. It was a frickin' circus. Jack Smith took that testimony, if we can even call it that, and that's what he based this most recent indictment on, was the bull crap that they barfed up from the quote-unquote January 6th investigation. They never even let this guy testify.
Yeah, but even barring that, you know, I mean, you guys are going off the stuff all the media tells you.
Michael, that's not
the media never told me anything about 9/11 being, you know, a conspiracy theory, you know.
We're talking about the supposed insurrection right now.
And I will tell you that that's not true. So you just said, I believe what the media says. This interview was...
No, I didn't say you believed what the media says. I said you're going up about what the media puts
out.
This
and that's what I'm telling Charleston
you. Interview.
Okay, so let me just tell you. No, I'm basing it on what that Capitol Police officer just said.
Yeah, this
and
is a Capitol Police officer.
Okay, so he goes on to say, and I'm sorry, Danielle, you're just not going to get to play it. He goes on to say that the audience, the people at January 6th was teeming with feds, and that he was not allowed to testify to that. Feds. Okay, so all of it's going to be revealed. January 6th.
Dude, I have video of where Capitol Police officers literally opened the barricade and let people in.
There's video of them opening up a metal door that you had to have a badge to get through. Okay, so that's what I'm saying. So they have tried to shove January 6th down our throats. Millions of people know that it's all a lie. Okay, the next thing that I want you to play, Danielle, if hopefully this one will work, is the clip of the Hollywood people trying to talk electors to be faithless electors in the 2016 election. Go.
Okay, I think I see it.
It's the second video in the twitchy, based on the new election denial rule, this 2016 video should put half of Hollywood in prison. It's the twitchy article I sent.
So there's Hillary Clinton something.
That's
and then
24
there's
minutes.
A guy
don't
with
play
a white
that.
Background.
the one with the white background. Play it.
Okay,
hopefully
all right.
This one
there
will
might
work.
Be a...
Republican members of the Electoral College, this message is for you. As you know, our founding fathers built the Electoral College to safeguard the American people from the dangers of a demagogue and to ensure that the presidency only goes to someone who is to an eminent degree endowed with the requisite qualifications.
An eminent degree. Someone who is highly qualified for the job.
The Electoral College was created specifically to prevent an unfit candidate from becoming president.
There are 538 members of the Electoral College. You and just 36 other conscientious Republican electors can make a difference.
By voting your conscience on December 19th.
And thereby shaping the future of our nation.
I'm not asking you to vote for Hillary Clinton.
I'm not asking you to vote for Hillary Clinton.
I'm not asking you to vote for Hillary Clinton.
As you know, the Constitution gives electors the right to vote for any eligible person.
Any eligible person, no matter which party they belong to.
But it should certainly be someone you consider especially competent.
Especially competent to serve as President of the United States of America.
By voting your conscience, you and other brave Republican electors can give the House of Representatives the option to select a qualified candidate for the presidency.
I stand with you.
I stand with you.
I stand with you. I stand with you in support and solidarity with conservatives, independents, and liberals.
And all citizens of the United States.
The American people trust that your voice speaks for us all.
And that you will make yourself heard through the constitutional responsibility granted to you by Alexander Hamilton himself.
What is evident is that Donald Trump lacks more than the qualifications to be president.
He lacks the necessary stability.
And clearly the respect for the Constitution of our great nation.
You have position,
the authority,
and the opportunity to go down in the books as an American hero
who changed the course of history.
And you have my respect.
You have my respect.
You have my respect.
For your patriotism
and service to the American people. Unite for America.
Okay, so one of the charges, thank you, Danielle, that Donald Trump is being charged with is that he knew the election was not stolen and he did all this stuff anyway to the point where he was trying to get them, the electors, to change their vote. And so that's one of the things he's charged with. I'm so pissed off at myself right now, too, because I had an article that talked about what that cop, the Capitol Police officer, told to Tucker Carlson. Former Capitol Police Chief Stephen Sund told Tucker Carlson that the crowd on January 6, 2021 was teeming with federal agents in a previously unseen interview. Stopping there for a moment so that you guys can understand why that interview was unseen. He was fired. Tucker Carlson was fired because of these interviews, because of the January 6 reporting that he was doing, and it was real reporting about what actually happened that day. And the bullshit that the American people were fed, and he got fired for that. Footage obtained by the National Pulse confirms, and this is an article from Trending Politics. It was printed on August 4th, written by Cullen McHugh. Previously unseen footage obtained by the National Pulse confirms previous reports about the contents of the interview. Earlier this week, the National Pulse released another portion of the interview where Sund stated his belief that the irregularities surrounding the day's events suggest a cover-up. If I was allowed to do my job as the chief, we wouldn't be here. This didn't have to happen, Sund told Carlson around the 19-minute mark of the conversation. He added that he remains pissed off about withheld intelligence and lack of coordination that occurred before and during the electoral certification. Everything appears to be a cover-up, he suggested. Like I said, I'm not a conspiracy theorist. But when you look at the information and intelligence they had, the military had, it's all watered down. I'm not getting intelligence. I'm denied any support from National Guard in advance. I'm denied National Guard while we're under attack for 71 minutes. The longtime law enforcement officer veteran explained. In the latest segment of the interview that was never released after Carlson was fired by Fox News, Sund described the large numbers of undercover law enforcement personnel in the crowd. Large number? large numbers of undercover law enforcement personnel in the crowd on January 6th. Court documents have previously confirmed that a number of D.C. Metropolitan Police officers were present, while federal agencies, including the Department of Homeland Security, have issued tacit admissions of their own. I had media reach out to me and go, hey, you were aware the FBI had undercovers in the crowd? I was like, oh, no, they would have told me. I had Steve Antonono, the head of the Washington field office, on a call the day before, didn't say anything to me about it, and now to see that they allegedly, according to the GAO report, had 18 operatives in the crowd, that's a lot of operatives. So when you look at the intelligence range, which the intelligence has handled differently than any of those big events that we talk about, especially for a big event that we see now, the threat stream that was associated with it, you know, whether it was IMF, World Bank, you remember the 2000, the Bush inaugurations, the violence with that. We would have had an executive briefing with the FBI, would have been called into the skiff, all the local chiefs saying, hey, this is the type of stuff we're seeing, he continued. Sun stressed that the events leading up to the protests were out of the ordinary. The Capitol Police did not hold meetings with the FBI and any other federal law enforcement agencies, despite such meetings being routine ahead of protests of that nature. But you think 18 is a lot for that kind of event? Carlson asked. He said, I think so. I mean, I was attending, so in fact, we weren't aware. And I think DHS is now saying they had a number of HSI, Homeland Security Investigations people in there as well. So it sounds like a number of the intelligence agencies had resources in the crowd. So it was in the parlance of the internet. It was crawling with feds. Carlson then followed up. I would say there's a fair amount of law enforcement in the crowd. That's why it now appeared when you add 18, I think DHI said they had 20, possibly 20 out there, if not more. That started turning into a lot of people, Sund replied. So I'm saying that, and Michael had to leave, he said life intruded, but that while it seems like it's never going to get better, this stuff is coming out. It's pouring out. They cannot hold the dam back. The information that with Trump and the indictments, so many people in the media, which isn't that great. After all these years, we can actually hear people that disagree with the preferred narrative on Twitter. Thank you, Elon Musk. Thank you, Twitter Files. Thank you, Missouri v. Biden. This stuff actually, people actually get to read it, and we get to find out. The interview that Tucker Carlson did with Sund has been censored for more than a year. Yes. So the National Pulse got a hold of it. It got leaked to them, and they're leaking segments of it, and it's bad. The very fact that he's saying that all of their normal protocols, when, you know, there's going to be a few thousand people in Washington, D.C., none of them were followed on purpose. And so you may ask, what's the good news about that? Information and our ability to actually hear it. And that makes me super, super happy.
I just want to welcome John Michael. He's here.
Hi, John Michael.
Hi. Hello.
Hi. How are you today, brother?
I'm doing okay. On a little
and our
expedition, just
Skype
listening.
Yeah, our Skype caller just very quickly raised their hand. But, you know, if you've got anything to add, raise your hand again. We would love to hear from you.
Okay. So, I love you guys.
We love you, too.
Yeah.
So we're going over a little bit of what's been happening. The good news report this week seems to be pretty good. Lots of information is pouring out of D.C., and I'm sure they would love to stop all of it. Of course, we know that... Oh, my goodness. Okay, so this might be some good news. So I'm going to mute for a second. Go ahead and take it away, guys.
Take it away, Danielle. Hello?
Sorry, I was peeing. I'm back.
And we're back. I'm all taken away, guys. I don't know.
Yeah, sorry.
I thought you guys were going to be talking about 9/11.
Yes, in the next hour, we sure will. Yes.
Okay, so I did get some good news. There's a five-month-old female Mally to be rescued, and I'm thinking about her. So think good thoughts for me as I arrive at that decision. So I got Nala when she was 5 months old, and this little girl has been with foster families for a while, so she's had some – she's been getting some manners, and so it may be that I may be getting another sweetheart. So we'll see. Okay. Wow.
I'm sorry.
What do you think about that?
When you stepped away, I had to pee. I was peeing, so I'm sorry about that.
Oh, for goodness sake. So we both stepped away at the same time. John Michael, did you take the whole show over? You could have been
– he was like, hi.
yeah, I would say that I fumbled the whole show because I was like, did I get disconnected?
No, you didn't.
So I would not say that I took the show over. And if you want to call that a takeover – I mean,
it was a non-hostile takeover if I ever saw one.
Yeah, it was a non-hostile takeover for sure. It was like, please take this back.
Okay.
People don't want to listen to me talk.
I don't want
you guys,
power.
They don't
want
to listen to me talk.
I do love you. But I will tell you that a really rough week on a certain level for those of us who I guess we could call ourselves MAGA. I would call myself MAGA. I believe in making America great again. so Trump got indicted for the third time. You might say, you might say that this is a little bit of overkill at this point. This is his third indictment, and
but we really got to get him, though. We really got to get him.
I guess that's the
that
will
you know I'm being facetious. I'm always being facetious.
Are.
I'm never serious when I call in.
Well, he's at 54% in the Republican primary. He's tied neck and neck in the general with Joe Biden. So absolutely, we really got to get him. Apparently,
yeah, get him.
There's already news that. That Jack Smith, now wait, I want everybody to, you know, hold your breath for a second. Jack Smith is not playing it straight with the indictments. It says Smith was forced to inform the court he failed to turn over all the evidence to Trump's legal team, made incorrect representation to the court. So we're already with the shenanigans. Trump made one of his tweets, but he's not on Twitter, on True Social and said, if you come after me, I'll come after
those
you.
Those are called truths.
Yeah. those are called truths. Apparently, based on that, though, Jack Smith decided to file a motion that Trump wouldn't be able to see any of the evidence against him in discovery because it could possibly put somebody in danger. I've never heard of a case where the defendant doesn't get to see the evidence against him, so I'm pretty sure that's going to get shot down. I will tell you the judge, though, only gave Trump two days, and one of them wasn't even a court day, to file a response to it. So there's tons of evidence that this judge is biased against Trump.
Wasn't he appointed by Obama?
It's a she, and yes, she was.
Oh.
And,
I thought all the judges were appointed by Obama that he's
well,
gone through.
You know what? Let me just tell you, Trump and Mitch McConnell appointed a lot of judges. And as a matter of fact, the one that's got the documents case is a Trump appointee, Judge Cannon. This judge is a whack job. She's been on the bench. She's had the pleasure of sentencing a bunch of J6 defendants. And her language from the bench, it's obvious that she's a frickin' one of those crazy eye people. So that part's not so good. But I'm going to read an article that I think kind of sums everything up with all the craziness that we've been seeing the last few weeks. Now, I'm going to do a little historical for you. There was a news aggregator called the Drudge Report. All conservatives had the Drudge Report on refresh for about 5 years. We would go to the Drudge Report daily, probably 50 times if you're a political nut like me. After the 26th election, Matt Drudge sold the Drudge Report, and it looks like the CIA took it over. So now we get our news aggregated from a place called Zero Hedge. One of the main writers is Tyler Durden, and he puts out some really great stuff.
Sidebar, isn't that the name of the main character from Fight Club?
I don't know. If it's a movie reference, John Michael, it's going
over
my head.
I'm pretty sure that's the name of the character, the main character from Fight Club.
Tyler
I mean,
Durden.
I could be wrong. I'm going to look
it up
while we're listening.
First
okay, yeah.
About Fight Club.
Okay. Nobody talks about Fight Club. Okay, that I do know. See, I just said if it's a movie reference, it's going over my head, but I do know that one. Okay, so,
okay.
So the opinion of Tyler Durden, and it's since we don't have Matt Drudge anymore, this is Zero Hedge is where we go. And so we trust this guy. The charges against Trump brought by corrupt Democrat appointees are for propaganda purposes and are for sidelining the candidate who the Democrats know will win the next election. That's how he starts his article. I love him. Many of the charges are based on interpretations or assertions of law never before seen in any court other than Stalin's purge trials in the 1930s. Start with the realization that the three charges and the pending fourth are charges against Trump when he was in office as President of the United States. The Democrats charge that a President of the United States committed numerous felonies amounting to four separate felony trials. Ask yourself how likely this is. It's not. Remember also that the Vietnam War, Gulf of Tonkin, bombings of Cambodia and Laos, Manning's revelation of war crimes, et cetera, real crimes, all never resulted in indictments of responsible administration figures, except for Manning, who was indicted for blowing the whistle on the crimes. In Washington's justice, it is not those who commit the crimes who are indicted, it's those who expose the crime. Enter Donald Trump. Let's start with the fake case of Trump's retention of some national security documents. Presidents and presidential appointees are allowed copies of their work in office. Among the many boxes of documents packed up for Trump, there were allegedly 31 classified documents. On the basis of these few pages, a non-entity named Jack Smith, a total failure as the head of the Justice Department's integrity unit, in quotes, managed to create out of thin air 37 felony counts against Trump. Not a single one of these charges has any basis in law. No one has ever been charged under these phony charges. Moreover, President Trump had the authority to declassify documents, which he says he did. But the Democrats know they own the media and the law schools and the governing class that defines what is acceptable. For these corrupt people, getting rid of Trump is all that matters. Every lie that serves the cause of removing a threat to the corrupt establishment is permissible. The next Jack Smith other fake case I skipped down because I don't want to bore you guys, but other fake case is that by challenging the stolen election, President Trump, while still president of the United States, was involved in a conspiracy to impair, object, and defeat the counting of votes. Think about this charge. The charge is not that Trump defeated the vote count, which he obviously didn't as he was replaced by Biden, but that he challenged the vote count. Do you see what this means? If a candidate challenges vote irregularities, and there were many in the stolen election, he's guilty of conspiracy to overturn the election. The alleged January 6th insurrection, also in quotes, was the work of federal agents at the Capitol while Trump and his supporters were more than a mile away at the Washington Monument while Trump was speaking. Only a thoroughly corrupt Department of Justice could configure an insurrection out of police escorting a few unarmed people around the Capitol. Ask yourself, how can 34 felony charges come out of a dispute over how a payment is reported? This is the Alvin Bragg case. The reason the Democrat hatchet men turned single charges into 34 charges and 37 charges is to create in the public's mind that Trump has committed a massive number of crimes. he must be guilty of something, because where there's smoke, there's fire, right? In the American system of justice, in which the media are totally biased against Trump, it is easy for Democrat prosecutors to create smoke. These indictments of Trump consist entirely of smoke. That such spurious charges can go forward constitutes proof that in the U.S. law has been weaponized, just like the dollar, just like the news. Okay. Other good news, and that this one is going to be my final one before I get on to Pedogate, because I've got a few for Pedogate today. Judge rules that Donald Trump has presidential immunity on false election claims. A judge in Pennsylvania determined that former President Trump cannot be sued by an election official over statements he made casting suspicions on the 2020 election results during his presidency due to protect presidential immunity. Judge Michael Erdos, a Philadelphia County Court of Common Pleas, ruled that Trump's immunity extends to a tweet he posted and statements he made during a Pennsylvania State Senate committee hearing in November 2020, which he alleged fraudulent activity in the state's election process, even though these claims were not backed by evidence. They always say that. We don't know. We never got to hear the evidence. The courts would never listen to it. The lawsuit was brought by James Savage, a supervisor of Pennsylvania's voting machines during the 2020 election. Savage combined two lawsuits claiming that Trump, Rudy Giuliani, a pair of poll observers, and others had conspired to slander him. Savage alleges that their remarks resulted in him receiving death threats and suffering two heart attacks. Other legal proceedings may examine the propriety of his statements and actions while he was the president and whether, as the plaintiffs in this case and other cases contend, it was this conduct which served as an actual threat to our democracy. But this case is not the proper place to do so. Here, Trump is entitled to presidential immunity. There you go. So lots of stuff in Pedogate this, and then that I'm going to close because I'm tired. A lot of it has to do with where Danielle started, which was the sound of freedom. There's still more people attacking the film because they're pedos, as far as I'm concerned. Where is my Pedogate file? There it is. So here we are. Danielle, I don't know. Can you go to the Pedogate file and play that first clip, please? It's at the very bottom. I don't know if I can share it to Seeds of Change. Is it possible for you to do that?
We lost her.
We lost her again, didn't we?
I'm here. I was on mute. I'm sorry. Peter,
it's okay.
Yeah, I'm looking now.
It's the very
and this
bottom
is the,
clip.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm.
Is this J.P. Sears?
Yep.
Okay. Here we go.
Finding at the end of this multi-month operation, this little red door in downtown Port-au-Prince, you wouldn't even think anything of. It was like a janitor closet. But you opened it up and it's a den of this Satanism. It was this dungeon-looking place, and these children were being there. It was the first time, actually, we ever walked in on a raid and saw the kid actually being... Anyway, we got the kid out, and there's four of them that came out. A couple of them had babies, and we found the infants they were using to, like, leverage the young moms. Anyway, the next day, we had our after-care team talking.
Is this good? Can everybody hear it?
Yes.
Hello? Yeah, good. Okay.
Yeah.
The girl couldn't believe it. She finally spoke. Her first word, holding a little teddy bear after being rescued. She had been kidnapped at age six after her parents died in the 2010 earthquake in Haiti. And from six to 16, I think, you know, she was just brutally for money. And here the red door opens. We go in and get her. And she says to us, is it okay for me to have hope? Like, can I actually have hope? Like, is it real? She couldn't. Why would she believe? She knew something about her life. She didn't know much, but she knew much. You know, this much, that she lived in the most obscure country, maybe in the Western Hemisphere. And worse than that, she was being held captive in the most obscure corner of that most obscure country. and a little red door. Who the hell is going to open that red door? Nobody's going to open that red door. And yet it opened. And here she got out. And I use this to say there are red doors everywhere throughout the world. Everywhere throughout the world.
Mm-hmm.
There's children behind them. And they are in places. Sorry. And they are in places where there's no hope. They don't think there's hope. The people living there don't think there's hope. The government officials don't think there's hope. They're not looking for them. But we will. We will go there. This last year, we took down a baby factory. I posted about this. I didn't know if it was going to scare people. But, I mean, these guys, these traffickers in Western Africa are kidnapping young women, children, as young as 13 years old, and impregnating them, getting their babies out, and then selling their babies immediately to witch doctors who are selling their organs or cutting out the kids. Sorry, I think your audience can handle this. You have the right audience, but it's cutting out the kids and they're selling them, you know, on the black market because people think that God will bless them. I mean, we've taken down two of these baby factories, rescued dozens of children from this, and we're still at it. I mean, this is the reality, but no one would be coming. No one would be coming. If we didn't come, and when I say we, I mean you and all your audience and everyone who's helping us, if we're not coming, I promise you no one's coming, but we will go. We will go anywhere.
Wow. That's nuts.
It is.
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy. So they went after that film with all their guns blazing. And Danielle got a big taste of it on her page, right? And now they're still doing it, though. It's pure evil. Latest media attack against Sound of Freedom is complete BS. Steve Bannon responds. It's just a bald-faced lie. So several mainstream outlets have reported that a funder, and they've even gone so far as to say a main funder, and, you know, talking about that he made the film, like they made it bigger and bigger and bigger, was arrested for kidnapping. We don't have the details yet, but what he did was he donated on the Give, Send, Go, or whatever they use, the GoFundMe, okay? He donated money when they were crowdfunding the movie. He was one of thousands of people that donated money. And so I went on and I looked it up, and there were 400 stories about how the founding funder for the Sound of Freedom movie arrested for kidnapping. Well, I dug a little bit, and then way down the page found out he was an accessory to kidnapping, something to do with a landlord dispute. I don't know the details, but he certainly donated money in a GoFundMe, like, you know, put in $20 for the movie to get made. And B, at first they said kidnapping, and then all of a sudden, oh, well, it was accessory to kidnapping. I don't know what this guy is. Doesn't matter. It's the way they went after the movie. Next thing, Epstein client list update. Gateway pundit doggedly seeks unsealing of sex client list at a Second Circuit Court of Appeals. In July 2022, the Gateway pundit lawyers Mark Randazza and Jay Woolman of the Randazza Legal Group, along with GP General Counsel John Burns, filed a motion to intervene in the Giuffre versus Maxwell case in the United States District Court for the Southern District of New York. Gateway Pundit is asking the court to unseal all records identifying Epstein's sex clients, okay? So we'll see. They're still fighting. Paul Saran says the feds are the ones fighting to keep Jeffrey Epstein's trove of documents secret. Comey's daughter, Maureen Comey, is the prosecutor asking for categorical withholding to keep from influencing supposedly just Ghislaine Maxwell's possible retrial is her reason for keeping these documents secret. We'll see. Backpage founder commits suicide ahead of federal trial. The Backpage founder, Jim Larkin, committed suicide this week ahead of his federal trial. Larkin, 74, died from a self-inflicted gunshot wound to the head. Larkin took his life on Monday ahead of his criminal trial for facilitating prostitution and money laundering with his online classified ads website, Backpage.com. Border sex trafficking cases should challenge Sound of Freedom skeptics. Austin, Texas. The American left so hates this summer's hit Sound of Freedom movie that their media have undertaken a campaign to discredit it. These generally assert that the film about former ICE Homeland Security Investigations agents' true life crusade against cross-border child sex trafficking is largely untrue, exaggerates the problem, or fig leaves QAnon conspiracy theories. Rolling Stone magazine treatment of the film, for instance, described it as a QAnon-tinged thriller. They went on to say also, and as a matter of fact, the guy that debunked Pedogate, the Pizzagate business, got convicted of child porn this week. Okay. Also this week, great news: 59 missing children found in Operation Cross Country. The Federal Bureau of Investigations, FBI, have announced that in a nationwide sting operation known as Operation Cross Country, authorities have recovered more than 200 victims of human trafficking and missing individuals, 121 of whom were minors. The FBI-led initiative, which was carried out for 2 weeks in collaboration with the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, Danielle's favorite organization, located 59 victims of child sex trafficking and child sexual exploitation, along with 59 missing children. The FBI, praise God. Collaborative efforts on Operation Cross Country have led to the identification or arrest of 126 suspects and 59 victims of sexual exploitation and human trafficking. So I think that's a great piece of beautiful news. And I'm going to end with that and ask if anybody has any questions, concerns, or comments.
No, I love you guys. I just wanted to call in.
Thank you, John Michael. I'm going to call about that doggy right now. I would love for you guys to send me some Danielle
prayer.
Some prayer, absolutely. Danielle, what do you think right off the top about me getting another doggy?
I think Nala will be in love with her, and yes. I pray for discernment.
I pray for discernment as well. I want you guys to have a great week. And
you as well. I love you both.
I love you both. Bless you. Bye now.
I love you. All right, so here we go. Here goes the 9/11 part of this segment. Unless you have anything to say, John Michael's gone. Okay. All right, so here we go. This is a flight attendant who was a flight attendant for American Airlines during 9/11. And this is her research following the event. I really tried to get this downloaded, but it only wants to download a minute of this interview. Surprise, surprise. So here we go with a flight attendant's research on 9/11. 3, 2, 1.
Rebecca Ruft, establishing herself as a foremost expert on 9/11. That combines about 30 years of her career as an international flight attendant, a purser. Rebecca has been able to bring into light what really occurred on that fateful day. Welcome to the program, Rebecca.
Well, thank you so much, George. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So tell me a little bit more about yourself other than what we just had.
Well, you know, I had flown around 30 years at the time of 9/11. I stopped flying in 2004. I really didn't pay much attention to 9/11, what happened. It really changed the career so much. So those last 3 years were not easy for us. That I could have been on one of those jets that went sideways there on 9/11. I missed it by about 8 to 10 hours. I commuted from coast to coast, and I just could have been there. I was home, luckily, and I watched it unfold. And when I did, I saw things that weren't right. But when you're doing this for a living, it's impossible to look at it in depth. We always knew that jets would scramble within 6 minutes if we needed them. And on that day we saw NORAD didn't scramble jets for over an hour and a half. I knew that the government, that our military was going to be there should we need them. So after I retired, a BBC article popped up dated September 23rd, 2001, right after 9/11, and it told that the Saudi government was threatening to sue the FBI and the U.S. government for claiming that six of its citizens were the alleged hijackers, and they, in fact, were still alive. And I was like, what? And at that moment, I guess it was my time. God said, it's time to wake up, lady. And I started doing thousands of hours of research. I used all of my years of training. We had specific protocols and hijackings on any evacuation or any emergency commands that we all knew. If I would have got on a different airline than what I worked for and there was some kind of event, I knew what commands they would use, and I could have just jumped right in and helped them evacuate the aircraft. And I knew their commands because it was pretty universal what we were taught to do. And that was one of the things that caught my eye. And then when I started digging deeper into the phone calls, that is really the training is what I kept going back to, is why did this happen like that? Why would they say these things? And we'll talk about some of those things later on. And the details of the calls, especially that the flight attendants did, because the FAA protocols in our training weren't followed by any of the flight attendants or any of the pilots on board.
How about the whack job that just charged the cockpit and he got tackled by the people who were on the plane?
Yeah, well, that's probably what would have happened if the scenario we were led to believe really did happen on 9/11. The aircraft on 9/11 were taken over remotely using what's called the flight termination system, and it's a remote control device that was sold to some U.S. carriers. It's a plug-in to Boeing's onboard computer. It's a plug-in device. I tell people it's almost as simple as a USB plug-in to your computer. Very simple. You don't have to rearrange your computer. But it was sold to some commercial airlines in the event, listen carefully to this, in the event that a hijacker were to get into the cockpit and take control of the aircraft, I don't know who we are, but I think I have an idea now, we can take control and remotely land that aircraft anywhere that we can get.
And there's nothing the hijacker could do.
That's correct. And there was nothing that the pilots could do on 9/11.
So you think, here are the pilots doing their thing, and all of a sudden, they can't control the plane.
That's correct.
Would they know instantly that somebody was guiding this plane?
They would never. It was sold in the event that a hijacker took control. They would never in a million years have dreamed that that device was actually controlling their aircraft. They would have just thought they were having some sort of mechanical. And the interesting thing about the flight termination system, and one of the reasons why a lot of the pilots and the Airline Pilots Association, their union, did not want this thing put on, is that once the flight termination system takes over via the transponder frequency, and so air traffic control loses track of you, you're no longer showing your transponder on their radar, and you lose all communication. You can't even communicate with the flight attendants in the cabin. And we are the eyes and the ears of the pilots because they have a cockpit door between us, them and the cabin. They don't know what's going on back there.
Interesting.
The information that I discovered was literally so mind-blowing for me. It made me physically sick when I really figured out what had happened and how it happened and who did it and how it was covered up. I wanted to take all the information that I discovered in these thousands of hours of research I did into the entire event, not just the airplanes and where they went and what happened, but everything. I didn't know about the Brady Bonds and stolen gold and the put options and all of those things. I only knew about the crashes and the hijackers.
Right.
And write a book so that it would help wake people up to what has happened to us. Because 9/11 isn't our past, it's our future.
All right, well, let's talk about what we were told, first of all. Four planes taken over by 19 Middle Eastern terrorists who had been training and flying, you know, at schools, flight schools. Are you saying that none of that occurred or that part of it occurred? What's your overall view there?
Well, what I discovered is, like I said, the first thing I discovered that six of those hijackers were a Saudi Arabian citizens, and the Saudi government was suing the FBI. Not only were they using their names, but they were using photographs from their passports and their ID.
Of people who were not on that plane, you're saying?
That's correct. Those people one of them had never been to the United States, and he didn't know what a Pennsylvania was. He was supposed to be on Flight 93 that crashed in Shanksville.
All right, where are those six now? I mean, why wouldn't... See, you know, if somebody had a picture of me as a terrorist taking a plane and they used it in Britain or the Middle East, and I'm here, believe me, you're going to know that I'm here.
Right. Well, the Saudi government stood up for its citizens and was threatening to sue, and I never could find a settlement, but I'm sure there must have been one, because and that was one of the things that really triggered my research, is that the FBI was being sued. These people were still alive, and four of them are pilots for Saudi Air. And being an airline professional for 30 years, I thought, whoa, can you imagine trying to travel as a pilot or flight attendant and being accused of being a terrorist for the new Pearl Harbor?
It's not going to happen. But I mean, why haven't these six, though, come forward to say, hello, here I am?
Well, they did. And as a matter of fact, you know, that's part of that BBC article, and their government sued. And what we were never told as Americans through our media and through the government handing out information to the media, that this lawsuit was either settled out of court or that these people really were alive. The FBI did eventually say that, well, there could be some mistaken identity and there may be a stolen IDs, but they never reneged on that. If you look in Wikipedia, those four or six citizens that are still alive, six of them, four of them are a professional pilot, they are still considered to be one of the 19 hijackers from 9/11.
Okay.
They never changed their story.
All right, then the official version, 5, 5, 5, and 4 of those four planes, they took control of the plane. They, you know, slit throats with some people with their box cutters. They somehow got their way into the cockpits. They all somehow got to fly the planes. I still think the one in Pennsylvania was shot down by us. So what do you think happened on that plane? Give me your thoughts on that.
Okay. Well, you know, one of the things I kept reverting back to is the FAA protocols and what the flight attendant should have said and done and what they did and what they didn't do, and just lining up with those protocols. One of the things that was a protocol, the FAA hijacking protocol at the time of 9/11, was called the common strategy. And basically that strategy was to delay, 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 and prevent the hijacker from getting into the cockpit. And that meant delay any way we could. And there were many ways for us to try, and that was put out there for us in our yearly training. And one of the things you wouldn't want to do with a hijacker, a real hijacker on board, would be sit on the telephone for a half an hour. And on flight 11, we had two flight attendants talking on the phone for 27 minutes. And the things that they said were what really woke me up. One of the things that the flight crew should have done was to sit down and to not draw attention to themselves. And what these first two did on the first flight, flight 11, is they sat on the phone for about a half an hour, 27 minutes, both of them.
How do we know that, first of all?
Well, because it's well documented. One of them called her supervisor in Boston, and the other one called reservations. And so the reservations agent and the security officials from American Airlines documented that.
Okay.
Only 4 minutes of her call was taped to the reservations agent. Something went wrong with their system.
Oh.
But the other gal, a lot of her stuff, and she was actually talking to a supervisor who was a personal friend, so that's how they know that was 27-minute phone calls. And they both called in at the same time. And like I said, if you had a real hijacker on board the aircraft, that would be the last thing you would want to be caught with, is a phone, a cell phone, any kind of air phone, anything to your ear, because he would think that you were ratting on him and telling the people on the ground who he was.
Sure.
And spoiling his plan. So making a phone call for almost a half an hour was a huge red flag. Not only did they not ever tell the most important bit of advice that day, if they had called someone on the ground, would have been how that person got into the cockpit. And that's the only thing they should have been saying, and they never did say that. So these are the things that I I looked at real closely. So here we have on that very first flight, two flight attendants call in. At the same time, they call in about 20 minutes after takeoff from Boston.
Well, let me ask you this first of all, Rebecca. Is it unusual for flight attendants on a plane to be making phone calls?
Very. Because first off, the cell phones don't work at altitude. And second off, those airphones are all gone now because they were horrible. You could only use one in first class and maybe one in coach at the same time. They were very, very bad quality. And they were expensive. So, that's the whole thing. The phone call thing is just really crazy. But, you know, according to the government story, they were mostly all calls from cell phones at altitude. So... Now, 20 minutes after Boston, they would have been pretty much at cruise altitude, probably close to 30,000 feet, depending upon the traffic pulling out of Boston. And this flight attendant, Betty Ong, they both call in at about the same time as well. And she says, this is the stuff that I could not believe. Now, I got most of this stuff from an FBI written document, transcript of what she said. And she said that he, as the hijacker was one hijacker, and he was a he had sprayed pepper spray or mace in business class, and we can't breathe in business class. Well, I've been on planes over this last 30 years where some real cheap perfume was sprayed in one cabin, and guess what? The entire aircraft smelled it and complained about it, right?
Right.
And so I knew that, and I knew that, you know, she's sitting on the phone for 27 minutes, and she never complained to anyone she was talking to about suffering the effects of mace or pepper spray. She never coughed. She never complained about having a hard time breathing or anything like that. And let me just say this, because this is kind of earth-shattering. Most people don't think about this, and partly because they just don't have the experience I have with that cheap perfume. If you sprayed pepper spray or mace in a pressurized cabin, everyone would be feeling the effects of it. That would be the hijackers, the pilots, all the flight crew, and all the passengers. That indicated to me that that plane was no longer pressurized. Because she said they only had trouble breathing in business class, and that's not real.
All right, so what does that mean if it was no longer pressurized?
That means it was on the ground somewhere.
Already?
Already. Mm-hmm. 20 minutes from Boston. And then she said something else that really got me, and this is when I told my husband, oh, my God, this is a message for a flight attendant, because only a flight attendant could hear this. She said he, as in that one hijacker male, he stood upstairs, and there are no stairs in a 767. There's only stairs in a 747. And I immediately knew she was in a hangar.
That's interesting.
Got the chills yet?
I'm getting there.
Okay, and then she goes on to say to a reservation agent, we're the first. And yes, indeed, Flight 11 was the first of the four aircraft. And then
I'm getting a little bit of a chirping on this, so I'm going to try to reduce the volume. If you guys are listening and the volume is okay, let me know. Okay, here we go. 3, 2, 1.
Realized that it was starting to look like she had been told what to say and what was going to happen that day by someone.
All right. Go ahead.
She kept trying to convince the people that she was talking to reservations. She said, we're up in the air. And she said that a few times. We're up in the air. Well, saying you're up in the air in a hijacking is kind of like saying when you were carjacked, well, I was in my car. Because, of course, your hijacking only takes place in the air, because if somebody tried that on the ground, we'd blow those chutes and get you out of the airplane. And so I thought, well, why would she say they're in the air? It's a hijacking. That doesn't make sense. And then she went on to say that she was seated at her jump seat at 3R, which is...
Right. If it was on the ground, it would be a plane jacking. You know, anyway, here we go.
The very tail section of the 767. The other flight attendant on the phone at the same time was giving completely conflicting information.
So the version that we have, of course,
mm-hmm.
you know, the couple of those planes hit the World Trade Center. Are you saying that, well, obviously something hit the World Trade Center and we're pretty sure they were planes.
Mm-hmm.
Are you saying they were not those planes?
That would be correct. And how...
This does not mean it was a hologram, right? And she will continue. gosh, John Michael jumped off. I really wish he was here. But I have to use my phone because for some reason the software only records a minute of this interview. But anyway, to be continued.
How I dissected this or deconstructed this was through all of the phone calls made on all four flights and the similarities of what they were being told to say. And then I charted, here's my devil's tower in the living room. I charted what the NTSB, what the FAA said the aircraft were doing. Now, according to the official story on Flight 93, the aircraft's coming down at more than a 40-degree angle, and part of that time upside down, while those let's roll guys were bringing hot water into the cockpit. Impossible in a 757.
Okay.
Impossible.
What planes, in your opinion, hit the towers?
What we saw hitting the South Tower looked like a 767, but it's actually a little bit out of sizing for the 200 series that it was supposed to be. And there's some kind of pod formations underneath it. There's some oddities that the pilots are telling me that they see too. And they want to know how in the world, have I figured this out? And no, I haven't. But how in the world did they get that aluminum plane? Because we've seen hail strikes leaving, you know, Chicago and Detroit and stuff. You can get baseball hail that'll just rip a plane apart and you can have a serious problem. Or a bird strike. I mean, literally, go make a hole right in the aircraft. How could you get an aluminum plane to fly through a cement and steel building like that? Airline professionals cannot grasp that, and that's the thing that I saw. I thought it was trick photography that morning. I could not. I just can't. I still to this day, I can watch that video over and over, and I can't understand how did they do that. Let me kind of continue a little bit with the other flight attendant on that first flight that sat on the phone for such a long time. She did something else that raised a red flag for me as a flight attendant and a professional. She did something that was a mistake that no flight attendant would ever, ever make. And she called into her supervisor and claimed that the hijacker was seated at 9B. And then she called back and changed her mind later. First off, you would never, ever call and say that a hijacker was someone unless you were 100% sure. And here is why. In that common strategy tactic, the FAA protocol, our job was to delay them getting into the cockpit, right?
That's right.
And then the whole plan was to land that aircraft. And if it had the flight termination system, somebody could be doing that remotely for us. I didn't work for an airline that had that. So,
now, let me ask you something. Would a pilot open up the cockpit door if they were told that hijackers were systematically killing people on the plane until they opened up that door?
No.
They would not?
No. The only thing that's really important to us as professionals, and this is pilots, flight attendants, pursers, all of us, when we put our uniform on, your safety as passengers and the safety of that aircraft are our number one concern. And so his number one concern would be to land that airplane
somewhere.
SWAT team. And if somebody died back there, it's not going to be all of him.
Right. And there's no way 20 minutes into that flight, the crew members would have opened up the door, gone to the bathroom. I don't see that happen. That happens later on. Later on, I've seen that happen on a plane, but not right away.
Yeah. Exactly. And so as I started looking at it, I thought, well, first off, if I called in and said 9B was the hijacker and then I didn't get a chance to change that story and we landed, the SWAT team takes over or the Army Rangers come in and they'll take that guy down. It's a mistake you just wouldn't make as a flight attendant. And so I for some reason, one day while I was doing all this research, I thought, well, gosh, I wonder who they said was this hijacker, 9B. And so I started to look, and unbelievable, the guy was a trained assassin. He was also an anti-hijacking specialist and a hostage rescue specialist. He was from a foreign intelligence agency. He was fluent in English. He grew up in Denver, Colorado. He was fluent in Hebrew and Arabic. He grew up in Denver until he was 14, moved to Israel, and then he learned Hebrew and Arabic while he was there. And so I'm like, well, that's really interesting. And then when the flight attendant calls back to her supervisor, she said, oh, no, I made a mistake. The hijacker was in 9B, and, I mean 10B, and not 9B. 9B's been stabbed by the box cutter, right? guy. Mm-hmm. So here you've got this guy who is a trained anti-hijacking specialist, a highly trained assassin, a hostage rescue specialist, who is fluent in the language being spoken by the hijackers who are planning the new Pearl Harbor, the attack of the century on America. And for no reason, there's no apparent reason, they decide to get up and stab him with a box cutter and kill him. Because we're led to believe that he died. He was stabbed by a box cutter.
And how did they systematically know it was him?
There's no answer to that one. And he was involved in the Israeli Special Intelligence Operations, referred to as Sayeret, Matt Call. These are the trained assassins, and they do the anti-hijacking and hostage rescue. So these would be the specialists that Israel would send to a hijacking, and like in Tunisia or someplace, you know, that go rescue their passengers. And they have actually been used. Benjamin Netanyahu's brother, and Benjamin Netanyahu was Sayeret Matkal, and his brother was actually killed in a hostage rescue attempt quite a while ago. Isn't that really interesting that we have this guy who is listening to these people speak Arabic and plan to take over the aircraft, and for no reason they get up and kill him, yet this guy, 9B's friends, said about him he could kill any human being using a pen and a credit card. Let's just move on from him because there is a lot, and there's a lot in the book about him. And so it's really interesting to me that the flight attendants were saying, one was saying a doctor and a nurse were taking care of 9B after she said he was stabbed. The other flight attendant, same flight, was saying there was no medical people on board. And so I'm saying, well, okay, there's only one reality inside an aircraft cabin. So I like watching all this stuff and reading through, and I just took massive notes and drew all these charts of what the government said the aircraft was doing. Some of the aircraft were coming out of the sky. I know you've flown, and I know you know what this means. 6 to 10,000 feet per minute. And you're expected to believe that someone's sitting on the phone showing no emotion, no fear, and that would be a very frightening thing. That is beyond if you were to do an emergency descent for decompression. You'd be pushing, coming down the fast. I mean, the aircraft makes very scary noise. People are scared. People scream. And none of that's going on.
So let me ask you this. Are you saying that the so-called hijackers, whether it was taken over electronically or not the point here, Are you saying they were not or they were on the planes?
The 19 hijackers that you are led to believe, I've actually found 10 of them alive. The other nine, they're fake people with a first name from somebody's ID and a last name from someone else's. So there were not Arab hijackers on any of the real passenger manifests. Another thing that's interesting about what the FBI claimed were the passenger manifests in that first 72 hours, they came up with four different names that are not, there were 19, but four of them were different than what they are right now and what they've been ever since, about 3 or 4 days into this event. And it's interesting because three of those people showed up alive. One of them was an FAA employee, and he said no. He was an FAA aviation safety employee in Florida. And so he, of course, went to the FAA and then went to the FBI and said, I'm not a hijacker. How could I be on the manifest? I was at work, and my brother, who you claim was also on the manifest, has been dead for a year. And the other two guys showed up alive, too. So quickly, while we were unfurling our flags and figuring out who were we going to point our guns at and kill over this attack, the FBI quickly changed their story. And the actual story about Mohammed Atta's rental car with the Koran and the flight manuals and his will was actually assigned to the brother, the FAA employee, and his dead brother.
Well, and I've got to tell you, too, Rebecca, of anything that I heard, finding a passport of one of these reported hijackers in the rubble was the most bizarre for me.
And they found two. One was in Shanksville and one was in New York.
In pristine condition.
And the only passports they found were from those supposed
hijackers,
not any passengers. Now, consider this, that there were nearly 100 people on Flight 11. And only one hijacker's passport must have gone from his shirt through the building, through the explosion, and floated down. It's amazing.
There were four crashes.
There were, but they were not these aircraft. These aircraft were all taken to the same location. And how I found that, one, I actually flew out of Boston for a while. I knew that the phone calls had to have been made on the ground.
On one of the flights from Boston going to L.A. that hit the towers, my uncle from my mother's marriage, he's still gone. So I want you to tell me where he is. Where is he and everybody else that happened to be on those other planes?
Well,
that's a really important question. And that's why I started the show with the cognitive dissonance conversation. Because a lot of people died due to 9/11, but not necessarily how you think they did. So let's continue.
You know what, as what I did to discover this is I kind of dissected as I've been doing these phone calls, and I took them flight after flight after flight, what they were saying, what the planes were doing, and I discovered that the people making those phone calls had been told about what was going to happen that day. And I'm sorry for your loss for your uncle, and I'm sure that he was more than likely an innocent passenger, much like the crew members, and they are all dead. They just didn't die the way the illusion was painted for us. Let me just put it to you that way. What I discovered, and truly, George, it made me physically ill when I discovered this. I took these phone calls and the details that were being made, and I realized that there was someone on board that was handling these people and telling them what to say. On the second flight out of Boston, flight 175, United Airlines, there was a young gentleman that used the term, and he called his father at 8:52, and he said that a airline hostess had been stabbed. And now, I'm in my 60s. I started flying in the early 70s. And we have never been called airline hostess. That's a terminology that's used in Asia, maybe the Middle East, but it is not something we have been called. We've stewardess until 1968, and then we've been called flight attendant. So this guy was 32. His entire life he's heard to us called stewardess or flight attendant. And so I thought, well, that's a really weird thing to say because that's not American terminology. And so then he did something else that was very strange. At exactly 9 o'clock, keep this in mind, this is now 3 minutes prior to impact in the South Tower. On that flight, he calls his father back for the second time, and he tells his dad he thinks the hijackers are going to fly their plane to Chicago and fly them into a building. Now, before 9/11, nobody in their right mind would have ever dreamed up that scenario, and it told me that someone had told him what the drill was to be, and this is what I think was happening. The handlers on board told the crew members and the passengers, did you know that there were almost a dozen war games going on that morning?
Yes, that I knew.
So they were told, and I can't even tell you how many American United crew members have contacted me. And because we would fight to the death to keep you passengers safe, we have deduced that the handlers on board had to have explained to them they landed at this place remotely using this remote control as testing the system, and that it was part of the war game drill or drilling air traffic control or FAA or some kind of story like that. Each aircraft had two people removed from it to make the phone calls. And they were put in a hangar in an office, and they were in different offices. That's why the people making the phone calls didn't know what the other ones were saying. Like the flight attendants on flight 11 giving completely conflicting reports about a passenger being tended to by a doctor and a nurse or being tended to by no one. Now, there was another guy that called out, and this is really interesting. This guy was a Top Gun fighter pilot trained at Miramar, California. It's San Diego. 6'2", 225 pounds. He fought in the Gulf War, 91. And at 9 o'clock, 3 minutes prior to impact, if you've ever flown into Manhattan, you know that New York is about 365 square miles. So 3 minutes before you're hitting the South Tower, you know you're in New York, right? And so he called his mom, and he told his mom they were hijacked. He didn't say much about the hijackers or anything else. Didn't look good. Thought he wasn't going to make it. And then she said, well, where are you? And he said, well, I think we're over Ohio. Well, Ohio is an hour and 45 to an hour and 55 minutes from Boston. He's a pilot. He should know that. And when you look out the window and you see Manhattan, you know you're not in Ohio or Kansas. And so I thought, well, that's an oddball thing for him to say. And then he says the one thing that was aha, my aha moment. He said 8 minutes after the passengers figured out they'd been hijacked, 8 minutes. Well, he says to his mom, a bunch of us passengers think we're going to go take over the cockpit. That's the scenario for Flight 93. Let's roll. And I knew right then and there that he'd been told or planned the scenario, because there's no way that that would be a coincidence that they would do that same thing that they eventually claimed they did on Flight 93.
Okay, now that flight, of course, went down near Shanksville.
That's correct. Well, that's
Pennsylvania.
What they say. Mm-hmm.
If you're saying it did not, mm-hmm. but something did, what was that?
Boy, it's hard to say. You know, there was the ditch that they showed, that divot in the ground, has been found on Google Earth maps from 96. So the local people, even the local coroner, said there was no bodies. And in any plane crash, and, you know, the listeners, I invite you to just do a Google image search on any kind of plane crash, 757 plane crash or just commercial plane crash, and the Google images, and you're going to see huge sections of fuselage, especially an aircraft that large as a 757, and because that's like an old 707, just missing a couple of the engines. Similar in size. It's a big aircraft. The tail is huge. And so there are parts of an aircraft crash that just don't disappear. That was the one thing I looked at that day and I said, that was not a plane crash.
I seen the pictures. It looks like there's nothing there except for a hole in the ground.
Basically, that's right. The only thing you could see from where we were was a big gouge in the earth and some broken trees. We could see some people walking around in the area, but from where we could see, there wasn't much left.
Any large pieces of debris at all?
No, there was nothing that you could distinguish that a plane had crashed there.
That's really all you see is a large crater in the ground and just tiny, tiny bits of debris. There's been at least one report that the investigators out there, and there are hundreds of them, as I said tonight, have found nothing larger than a phone book.
Nothing larger than a phone book. Can you imagine? Can you imagine nothing larger than a phone book from a plane crash? Well, this is, like I said, I'm glad I started with the cognitive dissonance. This is the next step. And we have to acknowledge these kinds of details. Nothing larger than a phone book was found at Shanksville. Now, I have relatives who live in Pennsylvania. I would love your opinion, your remembrance of it, how you remembered it, right? But we're not done, so I'm going to keep going. All right.
Well, we've got the controversy about the plane that reportedly hit the Pentagon as well.
Exactly.
They can't find bodies or much of the plane. Now, there was something that looked like it could have been an engine, but that too remains controversial. So let's make an assumption, Rebecca, that these four planes were taken and landed somewhere within a region where Boston is, I guess. Again, you're saying they did what with the planes afterwards? I mean, where are they now? And then those passengers, are you saying all the passengers aboard those planes were killed after the planes landed?
Yes, more than likely. Here's another thing that people always ask, we're so light. There were 30 people on one 757. That's nothing. It holds 180 passengers. And it was a, you know, coast-to-coast flight. So a lot of people have said to me, how come there weren't very many people on board? Well, I think that this was such a methodically planned out illusion that I think that some reservations phone lines were hijacked, and so that they were limited how many people. If they had been full aircraft, there would have been over 800 people to handle. But since the loads were light, then it was easy for them to put them all in the back section, in one area where they could make them do whatever they wanted and keep an eye on everybody, make sure phone calls weren't. Because on flight 11, nearly 100 people, I think it was 90-some people or something, with the entire crew members. There was the 11 crew members and 86 passengers or something like that. And yet only two flight attendants, those two flight attendants made a phone call, and they were on the phone for 27 minutes. So you got to ask yourself, why didn't anybody else make a phone call? Well, this is what we think, and I've gotten my head together with a bunch of airline people that actually knew the crew members, the cockpit crew and the flight attendants on those airlines, and knew them personally. And they are dead, too, as well. They really did exist. The flights did operate. There were people on board. And, yes, in fact, they were killed. They were just killed in a different manner than what they showed us on television. And so what we think is that each plane, and until you get to Flight 93, each aircraft had two people removed from it, put in offices upstairs in that hangar, and then they made their phone call. Each one had two people making those phone calls.
And these people did not know what was going to happen to them after.
No, they couldn't have, or the crew members would have fought back. I know that. And so I think that they were told by handlers that this is a drill, and they were removed those people off, those two people to make the phone calls. On Flight 93, they actually took 11 people off. There were 33 passengers or so. And I think there was seven crew members total, with pilots and the flight attendants. And once those people were removed, we are under the belief that more than likely, you know, how predictive program and the Illuminati like to tell you what they're doing. Well, one of the things that everybody said that called out almost every phone call said they sprayed pepper spray or mace in the cabin. So we believe that some type of gas, perhaps a hydrogen cyanide or some quick-acting gas, was in there, and they shut the door. And those airplanes are sealed tight. And that type of gas, some type of gas like that, would, before people could really react and open the door or anything, they would be affected by that.
Why would they go through, and then we're going to get into who they may be,
mm-hmm.
but why would they go through this exercise of landing the planes, taking the passengers off, killing them, and then send other planes into the exact spots that these other planes might have gone? Why not just let these original planes crash into the Twin Towers, into the Pentagon, and the one that crashed in the field in Pennsylvania? Why not just let it happen like that?
Well, now, I think that that's a kind of a common question I actually get asked. And I think that...
they seem to duplicate themselves.
Yeah, well, this was a sure thing. They actually could handle this as a sure thing. And what hit the North Tower was more than likely some type of drone aircraft. We really don't know what hit that, and it
okay.
could have been some military
hmm.
thing.
Well,
like
and we have our questions of, you know, why those buildings went down the way they did. Many people that I've interviewed believe it's controlled demolition.
Looked like it, didn't it?
Yeah, well, it sure did. You've seen enough buildings go down.
So to answer your question, why would they go through this? One, they needed the precision, and they couldn't take the chance that the pilots might override that flight termination system and take control of the aircraft.
At what point, though, is this speculative or something based on some fact? I mean, we really don't know that they were all pulled off the plane and killed, do we?
Well, I don't think they were killed off the plane. I think they were gassed in the cabin.
All of them.
All of them, except for the handlers that got off.
The handlers and the pilots.
Because all of the crew members, I mean, I have, you know, I have United and American Airlines pilots buying the book from the publisher in bulk, because they get them for about $11 a piece and handing them out. They are so convinced this is exactly what happened. And as I continue going through this, as we continue talking some more, I'm going to tell you some of the things. Remember I mentioned to you the Brady Bonds and the gold and all those things that I discovered?
Mm-hmm.
Well, those, the evidence for WorldCom, Global Crossing, and the Enron investigations were all being held in Building 7. That one fell down at 5:20 in the afternoon.
Well, I do have my questions on why that went down when it was really never hit by anything.
Exactly. And you saw that as a controlled demolition. I saw that too, and I thought, wow, how did they get that thing wired to demolition? I didn't think it just fell on its own, and then, of course, I didn't pay much attention to it. But after I looked into it, it definitely was.
Well, I will give you that there are huge inconsistencies
with the 9/11 Commission's report and what we think happened. Huge discrepancies. And things happened, the Patriot Act, and very bizarre things have gone on since, and they haven't stopped.
You're answering your own question. Why would they do this? Well, look at the wars we've had in the last 14 years. Look at what we're doing.
See, what I believe happened was that some people in government knew this was coming down and didn't do anything about it, that they had that ability to stop this.
Mm-hmm. Everybody should remember, what was it, September 10th, 2001? The day that we'll live in infamy. Go ahead and look up what happened on September 10th, 2001. Continue.
Stop them all. But they said, no, let it happen for the things we're seeing unfold today. And that they let it happen. They let these 19 crazed terrorists get on board. They you know, how they took over the planes, I don't know.
They're still alive, so you have to deal with that.
You know, it's just, I'll give you the whole thing's bizarre, but for me, what makes it stranger is the fact that, you know, you say the planes were taken and then the people were gassed and brought.
Well, you know, when I first discovered this, George, it physically made me sick. I missed it myself by not 10 hours. It could have been me on one of those planes. And to learn what I learned, and I'm not even done telling you everything I learned. I mean, I took all the information that I uncovered over, you know, probably 3 years of investigating, 20 hours a day. I lived in this until I dissected it, methodically dissected their illusion. That's the title of my book, Methodical Illusion, and that's what I did. I methodically went through every word that was said on the phone calls, why the protocols for hijacking weren't followed by anyone, what I would have done as a flight attendant. And the amazing thing to me is, I think my biggest fear once I discovered this was the flight attendants and the pilots, the airline people were going to hate what I found. But then I thought, well, it's not any worse than watching those people jump out of the towers or thinking that you're strapped in a seat and go into a building. Probably was a much more gentle death. It's a death is a death. And so, no, just the opposite has happened to me. I have had the most incredible response from airlines, even especially United and American people, that have said, you have figured this out. This is exactly what happened, how they did it. And you see, because I haven't told you this part yet, there were two companies involved in the FAA headquarters that were able to manipulate. They were actually there for the war games, making things appear that were not real on radar for those fighter jets that were playing the war games, that for the NORAD screen, radar screen readers.
What's the significance of that?
Well, they were able to make things appear and disappear. So once that flight termination system took over the transponder and the transponder turned off, the air traffic controllers couldn't see them, they have the ability to create fake flight plans and have those planes go anywhere they wanted to.
What's the bottom line? What did they want to accomplish after they did this?
I think it was what's considered a false flag. I mean, you have the Project for New American Century, PNAC it's referred to, and you can Google search this on Wikipedia, explains it really well. There were a group of people that actually planned, and they said in this plan, the necessity to get the American people behind these seven wars coming in the Middle East. A new Pearl Harbor were the words they used in the Project for the New American Century. And you can look back now. Hindsight's always 2020, isn't it, George?
Sometimes it is.
Yeah, and so when we look back, and I think what's happening, and instead of the people, I thought people would be angry at this what I discovered, and what I discovered, I mean, I have not had anybody try to even attempt to refute this, especially airline people. They're just on board. It's just, you figured this out. This is exactly what happened.
I don't mean to interrupt, and we're going to keep going, but it seems like we've got a caller the software does not show a hand up, but looks like might want to say something. I'll briefly unmute you just to make sure. Sorry, it's like a technical glitch, but Hi, this is Seeds of Change. Would you like to say something, or are you just listening? Okay, just listening. All right. Sorry, just weird glitch.
And these are their coworkers, and especially because most of these people are coming from American and United. It was very difficult for me. I truly was physically ill. I couldn't write. I couldn't even think or eat for a while once I discovered what I did, because it was very tough, and I was so close to being there. So what I found are these companies that were able to manipulate the radar. They showed us what they wanted on radar. And I just got a Facebook from someone that said to me they knew Betty Ong and flown with her, and she would never have stayed on the airplane 20 minutes, and that she was an excellent flight attendant and followed all the rules. So, you know, that's the kind of support I get, and those are the people to me that are important. And, you know, that's who I dedicated myself to, find the planes, the passengers, and the crew, because that was my world. That was my life. And I realized this, George, that those phone calls, they had to have been made. They had to have been made so we knew who to shoot, who to aim our guns at, who to unfurl our flags and attack, and who to support. So what wars they, and the terminology that they used was the most obnoxious and craziest. I've flown for 30 years. I flew out of Amsterdam with, you know, probably 80 different ethnic groups and 65 different languages or more. And I would never say about someone, you or anyone else, he's of Middle Eastern descent. And those words right there were used by almost every phone caller in that same terminology.
Like it was scripted?
Very much so. Mm-hmm. And these are the things I found. That's how I realized that this was scripted, and it wasn't protocol, and it was crazy stuff to say. And I realized then that if we didn't know that the hijackers were Middle Eastern descent, we wouldn't be able to go to those wars now, would we?
I don't think cell phones work on planes up there 30,000 feet.
They absolutely did not.
I'm pretty sure they don't.
They still don't. I just recently flew in about 1,800 feet. I lost cell reception. As a matter of fact, a friend of mine's a private pilot, and he said he turned his phone on at about 5,000 feet, and his phone said forbidden.
Well, wasn't there also a reported call from Barbara Olson to her husband?
Yes, on Flight 77, there were, again, two people that called, and it was one flight attendant, Renee May, who called her mom and dad, and Barbara Olson, who was married to the Solicitor General, Department of Justice, Ted Olson. And she was a CNN commentator, and she's the only person that reported their weapon was a box cutter. And so it's interesting, that story, that's kind of a side story that, I mean, it's really kind of fascinating, because Ted Olson first said she called in collect from a cell phone. Well, that's impossible. And then he said, no, she called from an airphone. Well, I've had people from American Airlines tell me that, of course, they knew better, because their 757s had all of their onboard airphones decommissioned by January 31st, 2001. So we know she didn't call from an airphone. She had to have called from her cell phone on the ground. 2001, I remember standing in a 757 back galley with a bunch of flight attendants. We all had different carriers, AT&T, Mobile, T-Mobile. Do you have any bars? Do you have any reception? The aircraft itself is somewhat of a Kip Faraday cage because of the wiring and the metal, the aluminum.
I'll give you the fact that everything involved in that tragedy that day was very strange. Everything, including the reaction of President Bush when he was with the little kids in Florida. Buildings like that just don't collapse and fall. If there was controlled demolition, and I've talked to a lot of experts about it, Richard Gage, Dr. Judy Wood, if it was controlled demolition, they would have had to have put things in that building weeks before this happened. Don't you agree?
Yeah, I'm sure of that. My main thing was the airplanes and how they did that. But I still got into that part of it, too. And I'm pretty sure they used multiple methods for the towers especially. It would have taken some time, but I know that bomb-sniffing dogs were removed a week or two before. There was a power down the weekend before. And so there was a lot of really suspicious things going on, and a lot of interesting people connected to the security at that building.
So what you're concluding, and I don't want to put words in your mouth,
but I will. There's a rogue element of government, and that they are totally out of control.
That would be correct. There was a journalist, an investigative journalist by the name of Danny Casolaro. Danny Casolaro was on the trail of the octopus, and he was following, and I found all these people too, the Iran-Contra, drugs for arms, the Pan Am 103, heroin, and even back to the Kennedy assassination. And everyone that I've found connected to 9/11 somehow connects back to one or all of those events as well. The octopus, I refer to it in the book, is like the shadow government, the company that I was telling you was in the FAA headquarters for 2 years, manipulating radar. MITRE, it's called MITRE, and it is basically the shadow government. I'm old enough to remember when Kennedy was assassinated, and I remember hearing this military-industrial complex took him out, assassinated him, and I never did figure out who that was until I did this research, and it's very much so the same people involved. And the fact that it's okay for us as a nation and our FBI and our government officials, it's okay for us to claim that 19 Arabs did this when they in fact didn't, and then we can go bomb all the other countries that weren't even involved in it over this. And we're doing this all on the illusion that 9/11 was. And it's very sad to see that what has come out of this. And we have literally killed millions of people on an illusion. And it's to keep the military-industrial complex alive. There are rogue elements inside and outside of our government that can do things without any government responsibility. I even found two women involved, not man Arab hijackers. I found two women perpetrators or handlers in this in an FBI document.
Well, there's no doubt about that. We've seen what they tried to do with false weapons of mass destruction with Iraq. And as soon as we left, everything fell apart because, once again, we screwed up everything we touched. We seemed to meddle with a drastic foreign policy. Somehow between World War II, where we were brilliant, and what happened afterwards with Vietnam and everything else, everything fell apart. You know, people... We really don't want to think that there are factions within countries that could do things like this.
Well, my world fell apart when I discovered it, so I agree with you.
And it all goes back to the Kennedy assassination. You know, after 1963, they figured that they can get away with anything they wanted. We need something to get the Americans just all upset. So they create that we were attacked.
Exactly.
And we go, and we saw that disaster. So, you know, on and on and on, the situation again with Saddam Hussein, who was not a Boy Scout, but you know, we set him up. And look what's happened now. So of everything you've uncovered, what do you find to be the most disturbing aspect of all of this?
Well, you know, once you get over... To realize where we are today, it's pretty heartbreaking. I mean, we fought for freedom, not for this craziness. But here's something that happened to me after one of the first interviews I did. Now, where I knew that this place had to have at least a 10,000-foot runway to bring these aircraft, and all the phone calls and the flight times all worked to this one location. And during a interview, I don't usually tell that where that is because I want people to read the book for all the other reasons.
And I want to tell people, just to protect you, we're doing this interview with you. You're not home. You're at another location.
I am, actually, yeah.
It's important for people to understand that.
What happens is I found this reserve base, and it was a C-5 transport base just well within 20 minutes from Boston. It has 11,595-foot runway, plenty long enough to land that 67 heavy with fuel. After an interview I did, I had someone contact me that was in a reserve unit based there. And this woman was absolutely freaked out. She told me exactly where the base was, the name of it. She was based there, and the reserves went active that morning. On 9/11, they activated her unit. She said when they got to the base.
Before or after things happened?
After things started happening that morning.
Well, that's not unusual.
But here's what's unusual. When they got to the base, it had been evacuated of all personnel, and they were locked out and sent to hotels for 2 to 3 days. And she didn't know
because those four aircraft were there. And these have, this particular place has large hangars, large enough for a C-5 transport. You know how big they are? Bigger than a 747.
Yeah, they're huge.
So easily they could have pulled these things in there. Also, every, I even hate to say this, but it's necessary. The future plan is not a pretty picture. We need to wake people up, and we need to get them prepared.
Now, where are the planes today?
That is a great question. And, you know, it's an interest. I found another interesting character involved in all of this this whole thing. You'll remember the missing or misplaced $2.3 trillion from the Pentagon that was announced by Donald Rumsfeld the day before.
There's always money missing.
He had announced that on television the day before 9/11. Well, the comptroller of the U.S. Pentagon was Rabbi Dov Zakheim. Zakheim also owned the company that made the flight termination system. That's the system that we use to run our drones around the world still to this day. He also had a subsidiary company. That company is called SPC that makes the flight termination system that was sold to Boeing to remotely take over the aircraft. He also had a subsidiary company called TriData. TriData came in and did a lot of the construction after the 93 bombing of the World Trade Towers. So they had actually the blueprints to the tower. He also was involved with a consortium, a group of people that did something else, and this will make the hair on the back of your neck stand up. They refurbished commercial 767s and turned them into military refueling tankers and sold them to militaries around the world.
Well, and those planes were going so fast, if you blink, you're going to miss it.
1 minute before impact, the flight attendant that was on the phone, Amy Sweeney, was asked by her supervisor, can you tell where you are? She'd been flying 13 years, and anybody that's ever flown in and out of LaGuardia, Newark, or JFK knows where you are. When you look out the window and you're over New York, you know where you're at. You're over New York. And she said, I see buildings, I see water, oh no, crash, boom. And any flight attendant that's been flying more than a month, that's been in the New York once, can look out the window and say, we're over New York. And so I found that really odd as well. Plus, again, there is no sound of jets in those phone calls. And that was another thing that almost everybody on the receiving end of all those phone calls said, it was dead quiet.
All right, I want to read something that Mark Birnbach, who was a Fox reporter in New York at the time, said, it definitely didn't look like a commercial plane. I didn't see any windows on the side. Again, it was not a normal flight that I've ever seen at any airport. It had a blue logo on the front, and it did not look like it belonged in the area.
Including some police and fireboats that it flew right over. They claimed it was a military jet.
Good observation. Good observation, Dennis. What is your biggest conclusion about all of this?
I guess, simply put, it was a very, very well thought out, methodical illusion, a false flag, an inside job. Later on, found out in my research that on August 6th, Condoleezza Rice and George Bush were passing around some sort of document, and they knew that this was going to happen. If they would have wanted to stop it, George, do you know all the FAA had to do was send out one directive to the pilots and flight attendants of this country,
and
we would never have let them on board. But now we're finding out that they might not have even been on board, because 10 of them are still alive.
Some members of the 9/11 commission don't think.
I hate to cut this short, but we're about 90 seconds out, so... Wow, I know that's a lot. And I wanted to wrap up this show by saying this is going to be a rough couple weeks, you know, four more weeks. The first hour of the show, we covered cognitive dissonance. I would say that most people who listen to this show already know what it is. If not, go back and look. It has to do with cognitive dissonance, specifically surrounding 9/11. So the second audio, is a lot of food for thought. You know, it's going to be available on iHeart tomorrow. Maybe do it in, you know, double speed or, you know, whatever, but listen to it. It's good information. And I'm lucky that I have the privilege to give this to you guys, to let you guys see this, to share this knowledge. So thank you all for listening. I had some great family here today to support this first inaugural of the series of 9/11. I love you all. Please share this if you can. And we will talk to you soon. Bye.